right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We are here until 5 a.m. And it's Nick DiGilio. It's Monday morning. That means the guys will be here to review the new movies. Eric and Colin will review all the new films. And we'll talk box office with Eric as well. And my dad will call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we are going to talk about the most popular holiday toys for the past 100 years and reminisce a little bit about that and talk more holiday stuff. So that's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Let me say hello to my great producer, Dan Shugrue. Hello, Dan.
Howdy, Nick.
How are you?
Good, man. How about yourself?
Good, good. How was your weekend?
Very nice. Christmas activities. Went on the Polar Express yesterday.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, we had a good time there.
That's cool. And how about them bears?
How about them bears?
Isn't that amazing?
It is stupendous.
Yeah. I feel good for you bear fans.
Indeed.
I'm happy for you.
Yeah. Been a good times.
Yeah. And in the newsroom is Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Hey, good morning, sir.
How are you?
I'm doing well. I got all my Christmas shopping wrapped up officially this weekend.
Good for you.
I'm feeling pretty good about
that. Good for you.
Plus, I predicted this with the Bears. If
you
play back the tape.
Oh, okay.
I said they'd be better than 500. I was right.
They kind of
exceeded my expectations.
There's your safety net right there. Yeah. No, I mean, the Bears fans are just, I mean, it's going to be, who do they play next?
San Francisco, who just knocked off Seattle last night.
Oh, okay.
But they're 4-10 and a struggling team, and it'll be I think it's always hard for the teams to go west, though. All that's long flight.
And,
but yeah, they should do good. Should do well.
All right, good going for the Bears. Not so much for the Hawks. We have an express to play back too. A really non fun one. So, all right. And if you want to contact us, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. And subscribe to our podcast. Go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Every second of every show is podcast. And you can subscribe. It's free. And it will be automatically delivered to your device. And you can listen at your leisure, bro. So, hey, I had a fun weekend. I got to meet Robert Zemeckis and interview him with Patty. Patty and I interviewed Robert Zemeckis, and it will run either tomorrow or Wednesday morning on our show. Wednesday morning. Okay, we're going to run it on Wednesday morning. So Wednesday morning, you can tune in and hear Patty and I interview the great Robert Zemeckis. His latest movie is called Welcome to Marwen with Steve Carell, and it is magnificent. It is just phenomenal, and I loved it. And we set it up so that I'm going to host a screening of it on Saturday night. If you guys come on out to the AMC Rosemont 18, the 7:10 showing, I will be hosting it. So I'll introduce it, and we can talk a little bit about it afterwards. It's a film club event, the Nick DiGilio Film Club event, and the movie's going to be already out, but it'll be just us hanging out watching the movie. We'll watch it at 7:10. Tickets are on sale right now. You can get your tickets right now at amctheaters.com, and I will be hosting the 7:10 p.m. showing on Saturday of Welcome to Marwen, and we'll talk all about it. And it was amazing to meet Zemeckis. He's so cool, just so cool. And I was thrilled. And I said, hey, is it really unprofessional if I ask you to sign a couple of things? And he did. He's like, no, of course, it's fine. So. Yeah, he signed my Who Framed Roger Rabbit DVD. He signed my 1941 DVD. He didn't direct that movie. He wrote it. He and Bob Gale wrote it, the Spielberg movie. And then he signed my Used Cars DVD and put one of my favorite quotes from the movie on the DVD. Then he signed it. And he was an incredibly nice guy and like really cool. And it was fantastic to interview him, and you'll hear it. And he's from Chicago on top of it. So Robert Zemeckis, I got to meet him over the weekend, and it was pretty great. And I want to thank Patty for that because she set the whole thing up. Okay, we're going to take a break, the guys will be here to review the movies right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We are going to talk about the hottest holiday toys going back 100 years. We'll talk about that, and we got some holiday food stuff to talk about as well as we get ready for Christmas. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text if you'd like to get a hold of us. 312-981-7200. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. It is Monday morning. That means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Lots to talk about this morning after a couple of weeks of drought as far as like movie releases go. But the next 3 weeks, or the next week and a half or so, is going to be really, really busy. And so we have Eric Childress and Colin Suter. They join me every Monday morning to review the new movies. And let's bring the guys in. Here's Eric. Hey, Eric.
Hello.
And there's Colin. Hi, Colin.
Hello there.
Okay, well, let's get started because we got a lot to talk about. Eric, why don't you start us off with Mortal Engines?
Okay. Well, as you might have seen the advertisements for this, it's being advertised as from the makers of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And that's partially true. Peter Jackson, Fran Walsh, and Philippa Boyens wrote the screenplay for the film, which is based on a series of books. Set sometime in the future after a nuclear war where the cities of the world, the surviving cities at least, have been basically put onto, recreated as sort of moving targets, if you will. They're basically, you know, cities on wheels. And you have, you know, this basic warring factions, one side or the other, you know, the power mongers, certain people are trying to keep the historical artifacts alive. Thaddeus Valentine, played by Hugo Weaving, is supposedly at the forefront of that, but he might have more malicious intentions, especially as in regards to a masked assassin played by Hera Hilmar, who has designs on taking him out. And when she is discovered, when she tries an assassination plot, she's chased off of one of the cities, and there's another young man who doesn't believe her at first why she might want to kill this great man. But when he confronts Thaddeus about what her intentions might actually be, well, he throws him off a balcony, and the two of them team up to you know, find out what the truth of her story is, and you know, restore some balance to the power order or whatever the hell is going on. I honestly did not know what the hell was going on during this movie. It was directed by Christian Rivers, who is a visual effects creator supervisor who worked on all of the Lord of the Rings and the Hobbit films. So Peter Jackson clearly felt he was up to the task, and he certainly is in regards to the special effects, because if there's one thing this movie has going for it, when it does put in the time to, you know, concentrate on them, the special effects are, you know, pretty spectacular. They're very, it's very interesting to look at. As crazy as some of the ideas behind this movie actually are, it's amazing to me that, you know, after a nuclear war, you think more Thunderdome than you think people that have been able to cobble together all the pieces of scrap metal and create, you know, roving cities and things like that. It's just, it's kind of just hard to believe. We're not exactly sure how far in the future this actually is, but those you know, elements are still pretty striking to look at. And at times, I just kind of wish the movie had been put on mute just so I could just kind of watch this as a silent movie, perhaps, and just kind of, you know, kind of get an idea, you know, just soak in the, you know, the visuals in sort of like a Fritz Lang kind of way, because I didn't care one iota what anyone was fighting for, who the characters were. The guy that plays this, the guy that helps the assassin, I mean, imagine if you take away all the ounce of personality that Eddie Redmayne has. That's what this guy is like spending 2 hours with. Hugo Weaving is doing his thing. He's not even that interesting a villain this time around. I mean, there are cyborgs and other assassins, and you know, just plots cobbled together from, you know, tons of futuristic cyberpunk type stuff. It's like a blend of like the worst instincts of the Wachowskis in their later efforts. it's, I mean, the movie, as visually striking as it could be at times, really just kind of put me to sleep in between all of that, and that's quite often.
Yeah, this is bad, man. And yeah. like you, Eric, I had no idea what the hell was going on. I couldn't follow it. I didn't care. I thought the lead was weak. What am I quoting Glengarry Glen Ross there for a second?
You're weak.
So, and Hugo Weaving, shockingly, Hugo Weaving plays a villain. That's a shock. That's a real shock.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just going through the motions here. And, you know, you did mention the Wachowskis, but, you know, I guess, you know, it could fall under that kind of umbrella. But I find the Wachowskis, and I know that everybody has kind of fallen off the wagon with those guys, except me. I still like what they're doing. And I guess it could fall into that category. But it's just, it doesn't have nearly as many ideas as anything the Wachowskis would do. I just didn't care. It's long. It's over 2 hours, and I just, you know, and it, yeah, visually it's striking. I mean, they clearly spent, how much money did they spend on this movie?
It's $100 million production.
Yeah, and it's not going to make that back, that's for sure.
Not in the U.S. at least.
Yeah, so, but I mean, it looks good. Special effects are pretty impressive, but man, there's nothing else going on. Absolutely nothing else. And I mean, I was, my butt was numb a half an hour into the movie. I just I just didn't care. So anyway, on Mortal Engines. All right, Colin.
Yep.
Why don't you tell us about Vox Lux?
Well, this stars Natalie Portman as a pop diva, but the movie starts with her as a teenager who bears witness to a high school shooting in the late 90s, and now that event has kind of transformed her life. After she sings at a memoriam, she starts to become a bit of a teen sensation, along with her sister, who's kind of protective of her. But she eventually becomes a superstar. And the film touches on a few other cultural moments throughout her career that leads up to present day. But the real story in the film is her relationship with her teenage daughter, who's played by Raffi Cassidy, who also plays the teenage version of Portman's character early in the film. So she has a dual role here. And, of course, their relationship is rocky at best. But Portman's character has spent a good part of her youth and her entire adult life in the spotlight. And she's, you know, has to answer to her publicists and managers, played by Jude Law and Jennifer Ailey, and journalists who ask tough questions that she thinks are out of line. And that's a normal day for her as she goes out on this world tour in support of her new album. And Vox Lux is the name of one of her albums that she made. And I should also mention that the movie has a third-person narrator played by Willem Dafoe. And that kind of gives the movie this kind of element of that you're participating in this kind of historical fictional watermark in American culture with this character and what she represents. It's kind of gives the movie a little bit of self-importance that is a little too grating at times. The movie presents itself as this very culturally significant story, and even the movie adheres to that by giving, you know, chapter stops and an opening credit scene that's really closing credits and doing all these big directorial flourishes to get our attention and to really sit up and pay attention to what a significant piece this is. But by the end, I didn't really feel like anything was accomplished with that. I felt like this was an exercise in watching a lot of great actors, you know, play a lot of juicy roles, especially Portman. This is a very juicy role for her, a very showy role. And I think she acquits herself to it mostly quite well. There are times when I, you know, thought it was a little overdone, but that might be the point. This character spends a lot of time in front of cameras and spends a lot of time probably, you know, acting for people. Even though she's not an actress, she's a singer, but there's a lot of acting that goes along in that. So maybe there's, maybe it's not Portman, maybe it's just the character and her choice to play it that way. It's not a boring movie. Certainly, this is a movie that is rich with, it's full of life and tragedy and big emotional moments. But I was really waiting for something to connect it all together, and by the end of the movie, you do get to see Natalie Portman on stage as the pop diva. In performance, and I was afraid the movie was going to sidestep that, but I was, it was nice to see it happen because I think Portman does very well in that. But it doesn't add up to much, and it feels like it wants to be. And this is going to be maybe a pretentious thing to say, but there's a Salman Rushdie book that is along these same lines called The Ground Beneath Her Feet. And it felt like this movie wanted to be a movie version of that book. It really kind of has a lot of parallels to it, but without really the courage or the wit to really pull it off. So it falls kind of short for me. There's a lot of things I do like about it, but by the end I felt like there was something really missing in the narrative to really give it to make it truly memorable.
Okay. All right. Hang on, guys. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric and Colin are going to hang on. That was Colin's review of Vox Lux. We'll find out what Eric thought of it and what I thought of it after we take a break for the news right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And it also means that it's movie review time. Before the break, Colin Suter told us all about Vox Lux, Natalie Portman's new movie, and now let's find out what Eric thought of it and what I thought of it. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Eric, what did you think?
Yeah, I'm right with Colin on this one. When I saw the movie at Toronto this year, I mean, self-importance is kind of an understatement. Because like Colin, Colin said, you're kind of waiting for the entire movie to sort of, come to its point. You know, I mean, the movie, opens with this really horrific school tragedy, and the whole movie seems to be trying to make a statement about exploiting tragedy and sort of the cult of healing that can come as a result of that sometimes, and how then we forget about it, just as easily in the name of distraction and entertainment. And, so I'm sitting there like, okay, this is clearly what this movie is trying to go for. But by the end, it just seems like it's just kind of all lost. And it's like one of those movies that's it's kind of pointing the finger at you. Like, if you don't get what I'm saying, then it's on you. And it's not my fault that you don't get what I'm saying. And that, that's, that's beyond pretentious and self-importance. The movie was directed and I think written also by Brady Corbett, who's an actor who's now directed a couple of really, really ambitious films. I mean, this movie is nothing if not ambitious in what it's attempting to try to say, I think, but ultimately doesn't really get around to saying it. And there's a little more to say about it other than that. I mean, I think the acting is really good in the movie. I think Natalie Portman is terrific once she finally enters the movie, which is more than 50 minutes into it. I think Jude Law is really funny at times in it. I like this actress, Raffi Cassidy, for a few years now. I think the gimmick of having her play the young Natalie Portman and the daughter, I think that doesn't really work. It's more of a distraction than anything else. But yeah, so by the end, I was just kind of like, yeah, okay, great, nice try, move on.
Okay, I think I liked it more than you guys did. It does have an air of pretentiousness to it, but I think there's some really provocative stuff in the movie, and I think it's I think it does make a pretty important statement about exploitation. But the key to this movie to me is Portman. I think Portman's great in it. Like it's a really, really good performance, and Jude Law is quite good too. I agree with you about the stunt casting. It is a distracting element to the movie. But overall, I was entertained by this movie, and I thought it was interesting. But I think it's propelled almost singularly by Portman. I think she's tremendous in this movie. It's one of my favorite Natalie Portman performances of all time. So I'm going to recommend it. You know, it's not a perfect movie. There are flaws to it, and it's a little grating here and there. But overall, I like the statement, I like the style, and I really, really like Natalie Portman. So I'm recommending Vox Lux almost entirely because of Natalie Portman, which I think is great in it. Okay, all right. Let's see, Eric. Why don't you tell us about Ben Is Back?
Okay, well, this is the latest film from Peter Hedges. Gave us Pieces of April, and the movie stars Julia Roberts as a mother and a family who returns home. It's like the day before Christmas. Returns home with her family and finds that her eldest son is waiting for them outside the house. This is not a normal thing because he's actually been away in rehab, and we don't know all the circumstances regarding this, but the rest of the family outside of Julia Roberts' mother is not particularly happy to see him. They're very cautious about even letting him in the house, letting him spend any specific time with them. Mom is a lot more forgiving at first and is just really happy to have her son and potentially have him there for Christmas, even though, you know, he says that he's been giving time off from his rehab stay. We're not exactly sure, you know, if he can be trusted at all. So the family manages to sort of solve their differences and you know, allow him to stay under very strict guidelines. And hopefully they can have a nice Christmas together. But the film then, you know, kind of shifts tones and discovers that there's actually going to be a lot more trouble over the holiday because Ben is back. And this leads to kind of a split movie in a way, where the second half sort of involves the sort of the converging of the past and the present and exactly a lot of the details about why, you know, he went to rehab and you know, why it's probably best that he's actually not around the family for the holidays. Okay, so, you know, this is not the first parent wants to help their, you know, addicted child through some things that we've had this season. We've had Beautiful Boy with Steve Carell and Timothée Chalamet, and I saw both of these movies at Toronto, not too far apart. I saw this one second. And to me, this is kind of a movie split into two parts, and it was a kind of an odd experience, actually, because I mean, the first, the movie starts, it's kind of following the kind of routine that we expect a movie like you know, the story it's trying to tell, kind of going through the motions. You know, Roberts is really good. I forgot to mention Lucas Hedges plays Ben in the movie, and he's also quite good. But it's sort of, you know, kind of familiar. But, you know, as the sort of the first half of the movie goes along, it gets to a point where, like, I felt like, okay, well, this would actually make a nice ending to this story. And I didn't even realize that we were only halfway through the movie, because it actually felt like kind of a natural kind of way to end the movie is a scene in a church that I think, you know, would have sufficed as a good ending to a very short movie. But then the movie shifts gears in the second half, and it becomes this sort of this all-night journey through his past, and that stuff felt a lot more cliched than the setup of the movie, to the point that it felt far more phony, it felt far more routine, it felt scripted, and I wasn't willing to follow it along this path. There's a scene at a mall at a food court that actually made me laugh out loud in the theater, involving someone on an elevator just happens to see Ben across the way, and that scene actually made me laugh out loud. I thought it was pretty ridiculous. But this is the second half of the movie. I think it just kind of betrays what I think was gearing up to be a nice story about acceptance and about trying to mend these wounds within this family. So I think the first half of the movie works, and you get to the church scene. If you leave after that church scene, I think you've seen a pretty decent short movie. If you stay to the end, I think that you're going to see how much better Beautiful Boy did all of this.
Okay. All right. Colin?
I liked it more than Eric did. I was with this movie, really. It didn't seem to me like it was two halves. I mean, I get where you're coming from with that, but I don't think I would have bought it if it was just a nice story that ended at the church, because this is something that, cripples a lot of families, and it takes, almost, decades to bring things back to normal if you're lucky to get it back to normal or any semblance of normalcy. So I think, it's the first half is stronger, but I think the second half, needs to have something there to give this more of a conflict and more of a balance to, what families really go through with this stuff. And I think mostly the second half works because of Julia Roberts. I think she gives a really terrific performance here. There's a lot of scenes where she kind of has to lie to the rest of her family about what's going on. And, she's almost making her complicit in all of this. And, you kind of see where a little bit of her son's behavior comes from and how he has to sort of manipulate the family into believing what he's trying to sell them. And I found that conflict, that dynamic, very compelling. This is an interesting movie from a director of Pieces of April, because that took place on a holiday about a fractured family trying to, with one member trying to bring everyone back together and hold it together if possible. And this movie kind of covers those same themes, although from a different angle and with a different tone and a different perspective. But I think it's an interesting return to that territory. So, yeah, I mean, it's not a perfect film. Yeah, I agree. The scene in the mall is kind of silly. There's moments like that are, just a little too, a little too convenient, kind of elicits a bit of an eye roll. But based on the performances and some of the direction here, I think it's a good film. Is it as good as Beautiful Boy? No, but I think on its own, it works. And I was actually very moved by a scene that happens early in the film in a cemetery. Even though I had seen part of it in the trailer, it still really got to me. So I'm actually recommending this one.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on a second, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Colin are going to hang on. We're going to take a break. Come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Ben is Back. And that's coming up right here on 720 WGN. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. Also, we're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right, we are in the middle of the movie reviews. Every Monday morning, Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me to review the new movies. And we got a bunch to review this morning. So let's get back to it. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'll tell you what I thought of Ben is Back. This is the latest movie with Julia Roberts, Lucas Hedges, Courtney Vance. And I'm leaning more towards Colin on this one. There are things about this movie that I really, really loved, particularly the performances. I think all the performances are good. It's not, now, again, I would say that it's not nearly as good as Beautiful Boy, which is a movie that I just thought was fantastic. But I think there's a lot of elements here that work. And I think it's a really a complicated and kind of a wonderful performance by Julia Roberts, hanging this whole thing together. You know, the second half of the movie isn't quite as strong as the first, but I was with it all the way through. I cared about what was going on. I was moved by it. And I think, again, you know, like the last movie we were talking about, Vox Lux, it might not be the greatest movie in the world, but it was propelled by some good performances, particularly by Natalie Portman. Same thing here. You know, Lucas Hedges, man, he's a terrific actor. He's a really, really good actor. His dad wrote and directed this, and clearly wrote it for him. And it does explore some of the similar themes that Pieces of April explored. I think Pieces of April is a much better movie. But overall, I found this movie to be compelling, and it's mostly because of the central performances. It does get things right and it does get things wrong, but overall I'm recommending it. I think the story is pretty compelling and the acting is really terrific. So I'm recommending Ben is Back. All right, let's see. Colin, why don't you tell us about Shoplifters?
All right. Well, this is a film from Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda. I think I'm pronouncing that right. He directed a movie called After the Storm last year, and a few years ago he did a film called Like Father, Like Son, not to be confused with the Kirk Cameron Dudley Moore movie. And this is about a family of people who are on the outskirts of normal society. They don't have a lot of money. The parents take really odd jobs, if they actually work at all. And the kids, everyone actually has taken to shoplifting to get food on the table and to make ends meet. And now they've just taken in a little girl who they learn comes from a bad household. They find her, they take her in and just make her one of them. And as the girl assimilates to this new life, we start to discover things about this family that was never made clear from the outset. You know, where they came from, what they've done in the past, who everyone is. And the family with the kid, where the kid came from, they come forward in the media and present themselves as loving parents who are looking for their kid. So now this family has to deal with that. So this is the director of this movie is, you know, his style is very, very slow, very contemplative, and doesn't really judge his characters. And it takes a while for you to see really what's going on here. So it requires a little bit of patience on the viewer. It is full of wonderful little life vignettes, wonderful little moments that are big for the characters, but are going to seem small for the audience. The last half hour of this movie is a real heartbreaker. When you start to learn more about what's going on, and I was really just so riveted by this movie. The performances across the board are fantastic. The kids are great. The grown-ups are, you really are invested in them. You really do want them to kind of succeed at this in a weird way, in taking this girl in and not get caught, because you do get a sense of the life that she came from. But then the life that she has right now is certainly less than ideal, but maybe it's better, but maybe it's not. And you're really kind of torn throughout the whole film with all these characters and all these different situations. And I think Corrieta accomplishes something pretty amazing in the last half hour of this movie. Really kind of pulls the rug out from under the audience in a way that isn't jarring in tone, and it isn't, take you out of the movie. It's not like this big, fantastic twist that, like, shifts the whole perspective of everything. I mean, it does shift the perspective, but not in a way that is... that feels like you're watching a different kind of movie. It's really, it's all part of a beautiful whole. And I really can't recommend it enough. It's a really fantastic film. And it's playing at the Music Box right now.
Okay.
So definitely check it out.
Okay. That's Shoplifters, which is playing at the Music Box. Highly recommended by Colin. All right. None of us saw Mary, Queen of Scots. How'd that happen?
Good question.
I can't figure out why I didn't see a Saoirse Ronan movie. That just seems weird to me. I didn't have.
That's the weirdest part. Yeah.
That's so. Anyway, but I'm gonna. I will catch up with it because I won't miss anything that she's in. So.
I think it's precisely the kind of film that the studio wants us to see.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, this is the.
And they didn't let us.
This is the time of year that they release this kind of stuff. So,
yeah.
But, you got two of last year's Best Actress Oscar nominees in the film. So, we'll see how that works out. Mary, Queen of Scots, but none of us saw it. So, all right. Eric, tell us about The Mule.
Okay. Well, this is the latest film from director Clint Eastwood, and the first time he's been on screen since 2012's Trouble with the Curve. And this is based on a true story of a man who has worked in horticulture and sort of worked in Peoria, Illinois, if I'm not mistaken. And put everything into his work. He traveled a lot. He's big in his own horticulture community, but neglected his family quite often. As a point is made very early on, he even misses his own daughter's wedding, who's actually played by Allison Eastwood in the film. We flash forward a dozen years, and he's sort of lost his business and even lost his home where they worked out of. And he is someone at his granddaughter's engagement party, sees he has a truck, and he's kind of low-key off the radar, and offers him a job. And unbeknownst to him, it's a job running drugs for the local cartel. Shows up at a garage. They give him a phone. They put a package in the back of his truck, and all he has to do is drive it to another location, and they take the merchandise. He takes the money, and so it goes. There's a new a DEA agent in town, played by Bradley Cooper, and the DEA is not having a good time with busts lately. He has teamed up with Michael Pena to try and find some angle to nail the cartel and nail some of their shipments, this puts these two characters on a path towards one another. So this is kind of curious.
Eric, hang on.
Yes.
All right, we're going to take a break. All right, and we've heard about the plot of The Mule, Clint Eastwood's latest movie. We'll find out what Eric thought of it and what I thought of it as well. That's right here on 720 WGN. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. And that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we are going to talk about the most popular holiday toys from the past 100 years. And we also have some other holiday topics that we're going to get to. Our phone number and text number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. 7200. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All right, the movie review is with Eric and Colin are happening right now. And we're in the middle of reviewing this latest Clint Eastwood movie, which stars Clint, and it's called The Mule. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Eric, you told us a little bit about the plot of The Mule. Now tell us what you thought of it. Yeah.
Well, I was saying that this was kind of a curious entry into this particular season. It was only announced on the schedule, a few months ago. I think maybe late summer, early fall, that Warner Brothers put this movie on the schedule. And anytime you announce a Clint Eastwood movie in December, people are already thinking, potential awards candidate. But it was really interesting that Warner Brothers, not only did they not have it on their award site for the year, but it seemed like they were just kind of going out of their way not to even show this film to any press whatsoever. It wasn't until a number of emails and phone calls, I guess, that there was even a screening set up late this week here in Chicago. Up until Tuesday afternoon, it didn't even look like the movie was even going to screen. And then people started seeing the movie, and there was a lot of positive feedback about it. For me, I think the movie is kind of sitting right on the fence for me. It's a competently made movie. Eastwood, seems, with the exception of the 15-17 to Paris earlier this year, when he's making a movie like this and he's just kind of telling his story from A to C, he is reasonably successful at that. He shoots quick, he knows what he wants, and he's going to, just kind of get it over as quick as possible. Not that this is a quick movie, this is a 2-hour film. I think it's a movie that has a lot of individual scenes that work on their own. But I think it's also, possessing a really bad screenplay by Nick Schenck, who also wrote or co-wrote Gran Torino. I think this is a movie that is trying, it kind of skirts around certain issues with the story. It's really trying to lay home the whole family aspect. This seems like ever since Fast and the Furious put that word family out there, every movie is trying to just shove that down our throats, from Bohemian Rhapsody to this, that family is the most important thing, and everything I've done in my life is leading, has to lead back to family, otherwise it's all a failure. Okay, great, we got that. We see a lot of that in this movie. But then there are also aspects to it also that, a guy running drugs for the cartel, whether he knew it or not, at first, he gets to start liking it and then starts doing some positive things for his community as well with the money he's getting. The movie doesn't really seem to have a point of view towards that. It doesn't really, the whole concept of people having to do morally questionable things to do good things in society, I think is a really fascinating topic, but this movie doesn't seem to really want to tell, have anything to say about that. It's just kind of like, well, he just did this and then he helped some people out. Okay, great. But he was also, part of him kind of enjoying this, the newfound attention that he was getting. This is an old timer set in his old ways, and there are some really awkward racial stuff that occurs in the movie, and, a scene involving lesbians on bicycles that, okay, I guess we're just trying to say that old timers are set in their ways and they're not going to change, because there's a lot of, you young people on your phones today type stuff in this movie, and you can't change, how your daddy never teach you to change a tire, all that kind of stuff in it. Great. But there are individual scenes with Clint that are very good. I actually kind of liked the complicated relationship that he was having with the son of the drug cartel leader. I thought it was kind of a adopted son of the cartel leader. I thought that was kind of interesting, but at one point that just kind of goes away. It doesn't really build up a significant amount of tension throughout. The later scenes of the movie just don't have the kind of impact that that we hope that's kind of building towards something in the way that he was able to do so well with, say, like A Perfect World many years ago. You know, but Clint's, you know, gives a good performance in the film. I think there, you know, Cooper is fine. Andy Garcia has one particularly really funny line that is so funny that you kind of go, then you kind of wince at afterwards. So I'm like, by the end of it, I was just kind of like, you know, I didn't hate it, but I think that there's so much more that could be told with the story if Clint wasn't just so rushed to make it, and if he had a better screenplay in his hand. So I'm not recommending it, but I can't give it a full-on endorsement entirely either.
Okay. Yeah, I'm kind of in the same camp. I was underwhelmed by a lot of this movie, and it's a real repetitive movie. I mean, I understand that, you know, each time that he does a run, they show, you know, what number run it is, like it's the 10th run or the 11th run or anything like that. But there's not a whole lot of variation, you know, of what's going on in the movie. And there's very little, there's a scene where there is a pretty great scene early in when he discovers that he's in fact, because at first he doesn't look in the bag, he doesn't see what's going on, but then he sees that he's actually hauling cocaine, and it just so happens that a state trooper with a dog shows up, and that's really the only time that the movie ever really has any kind of suspense. You know, Bradley Cooper, Michael Pena, I think, you know, that stuff I think is funny, but you know, there's never really a sense of like them really wanting to track this guy down. And then like not knowing who this, they know that there's a guy hauling drugs, they know that there's a mule, but they don't know who he is. And obviously they don't think, you know, a 90-year-old guy like Clint Eastwood would be your target. And in fact, there's a really good scene in a Waffle House with Bradley Cooper and Clint Eastwood, and neither of them, you know, like he knows that he's a DEA agent, Clint does, but of course Bradley Cooper has no idea that this 90-year-old guy in this Waffle House is indeed the mule that they're looking for, because they went after a different guy who would fit the description more at this hotel earlier. You know, so that's really nice, but there's never really a sense of suspense. I mean, even all the way up until the end, there doesn't seem to be urgency on the part of Bradley Cooper on his end. It just seems superfluous, you know. But in the positive side, I think there's a lot of individual moments in this movie that really, really work. And Clint, I think Clint's very good in it. I think it's a really good performance and at times a very funny performance. There are a lot of laughs in this movie, basically generated by some of the ridiculous stuff that comes out of Clint Eastwood's mouth in the movie. But you know, but it never, you know, like the family stuff at the end where he sort of kind of goes back to the family. Diane Weiss plays his ex-wife in the movie. And as you mentioned, his daughter is played by Allison Eastwood. And there's a lot of conflict between them and, you know, all that stuff towards the end where he's trying to make amends. There's nothing in the screenplay that builds up to any kind of sympathy that we could have for this character and what he's gone through. And it just kind of like bops all over the place. Like the first, like, you know, 15 minutes of the movie, there's so much stuff kind of thrown at us. You learn who this guy kind of is and what he is, and what he is thought of by his peers and the people that he works with, you know, or in that horticultural world. But you barely get a grasp on what's going on with his family. You know, the next thing you know, they're just yelling at him for showing up at a wedding rehearsal or a party, and you don't really understand. I mean, the conflict is just kind of set up, and then that's it. And then he decides to take the gig, and then basically just goes on these repetitive runs, having some interesting conversations and some interesting relationships with some of the guys that he's working with. You know. And they tend to, at first, they think he's just this old goof, but then they like him, and that works up a sort of relationship. And then there's an extended sequence where he goes to Mexico and hangs out with, you know, the head of the cartel played by Andy Garcia, who I think is really really good in this and has a lot of fun. And then it just has like this crazy weekend where he's sleeping with two women. You know, he's 90 years old. He's got 20-year-old women rolling around.
I got to say, Nick, I was not expecting multiple threesomes in this movie.
And there are. And it's like, good for Clint. All right.
Yeah. Clint the director was taking care of Clint the actor in this movie.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So, but overall, it doesn't, there's no emotional payoff at the end, and there should be, you know, and I just didn't care. And I'm with you. I'm with you, Eric. You know, we all know that Clint's reputation is that I want to make a movie fast. I want to get it done. I want to be on the golf course by 10 a.m. And that really shines through in this. I mean, that's very, very clear that he shot this thing as quickly as possible. And gave very little direction to anybody.
Right.
And whatever, what, you know, I think whatever, in terms of performances, whatever stands out is just was brought to the game by these people. Because Bradley Cooper is really fun in it, and so is Michael Pena. Lawrence Fishburne doesn't have much to do, but overall,
no.
You know, overall, eh, you know? So.
Yeah, it's just the whole movie. I kept thinking about how good The Old Man and the Gun was.
Yes.
And
yeah,
I mean, you talk about that scene in the Waffle House. One of my favorite scenes of the year is the scene between Robert Redford and Casey Affleck in a bathroom.
In a bathroom, yeah.
You know, and it, that scene is so great, and that movie touches upon all the things that this movie you know, talks about, and is so much better.
It's a much better movie. It's a much better movie.
People, you know, wait to see The Old Man and the Gun, and I think you can kind of, you know, see this one at your leisure.
Yeah. All right, guys, hang on. All right, Eric and Colin are going to hang on. We're going to take a break, come back. We've got a couple more movies to review. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about the most popular holiday toys from the past 100 years and other holiday topics. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Eric Childress and Colin Suter join me every week to review the new movies. Let's get them back in here. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Colin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin, you didn't see The Mule, correct?
I did not,
okay.
No.
All right. All right. Well, let's move on here to Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Colin, tell us about it.
Well, this is an animated film for the Marvel Universe, but it doesn't take place within any ongoing storyline that we already know. This is its own thing, and it's about a teenager named Miles Morales who goes through the motions of the Spider-Man origin story. He's a teenager. You know, he gets bitten by a radioactive spider. But there's actually already a Spider-Man in his town. And everyone knows who he is. And but then that Peter Parker / Spider-Man dies. And Miles, while trying to figure out what his powers are, meets another Spider-Man. And this one is middle-aged, has some weight gain on him, and a 5 o'clock shadow. But nevertheless, he ends up being Miles' mentor for all of this. And eventually more characters come into play for this Spider-Verse, including a noir Spider-Man, voiced by Nicolas Cage, a small pig in a Spidey suit named Spider-Ham, an anime girl with the robot companion, and a female spider woman as well. And they're all part of another kind of dimension. And, you know, there's the usual comic book plot and within all of this about computer chips and closing off a dimension and saving the world, and, you know, bad guy who wants to, you know, get Spider-Man and get this computer chip and blah, blah, blah. So there's all the usual comic book plot to go into this. But this is far from the usual Marvel movie. And as we said last week, I don't think any of us really expected much from this when we first heard about it. The last thing I need is another Spider-Man movie, although I've enjoyed some of them. I enjoyed the last one, The Homecoming. But this is number 7. This is our 7th Spider-Man. This is like the third or fourth time telling another origin story, too. Luckily, this is the kind of movie that knows that
and is very cheeky about origin stories and repeating origin stories. It's kind of a running gag in this movie about origin stories. It's very funny. This movie has three directors credited to it, and that sometimes can be a cause for concern if there's if some director maybe got kicked off or maybe there's a lot of disagreements or whatever. But two of these directors are making their debut here. One of them, and the other one who's not, made a movie called Rise of the Guardians, which was okay. But this is far from just okay. This is spectacular. This is, and I said this last week, and I'll say it again, this is every animation lover's dream, is this movie. It is so alive. There's so much color. There's and playfulness and different genres, different types of animation going throughout this thing. You see, like, photorealistic animation, your traditional computer generation. You see a little bit of Warner Brothers, some anime, and pop art, often existing in the same frame, and done in a way that is just like, you just want to know more about the magician at work here, that is making this really trippy, very stylistically bold animated movie that is never less than thrilling to watch and to look at. I never got tired of this movie like I do some other superhero movies, like I did one that's coming out soon. I never got tired of the characters. I loved all of them. I was invested in all of them. Even when the movie runs the risk of overflowing with too many characters, I can't imagine this movie without a single one of them. And like a lot of Marvel movies, I'm more invested in these characters than I am in the plot with the computer chip and the dimension and blah, blah, blah. But once that stuff actually comes into play, it's still fun to watch just for the animation and just watching the style of the animation change on a dime. And yet still it flows beautifully. And God, there are some funny gags in this movie. This is really one of the funniest films of the year. And, it's probably no surprise because it's co-authored or co-produced by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, the guys behind the Lego Movie and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. They got kicked off of Solo, and now I'm really mad about that because God knows what kind of movie they had in mind. But if it was anything like this, we really lost out. I never thought I was going to see a Spider-Man movie, let alone the animated Spider-Man movie, crack my top 10 list, but that's where this is at for me right now. I loved this movie. I can't wait to see it again, and I want everyone to go see it.
All right. Hang on, guys, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric and Colin are going to hang on, and when we come back, we'll find out what Eric thought and what I thought of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Coming up right after this on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. And then we've got the Monday morning movie reviews, which we're in the middle of right now. Let's get back to that. Eric Childress, welcome back.
Thank you.
Colin Suter, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right, Eric, what did you think of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse?
Yeah, it's really good. And I haven't reached quite the level of cynicism that Colin has with the whole comic book universe. But even I was saying when I heard that this project was announced that, why do we need, how far is Sony going to run their one comic book property, into the ground? How many times are they going to reboot this one character? Especially when, they got it right a number of times. But this movie is really just one of the complete surprises of the year. I love the new characters. And this is a movie that is not just all snark. This is a movie that could very easily, fall into
you know, not that Lego Movie was a trap at all, but, you know, Lego Movie is a series of gags, one after another, very fast-paced, very manic. And, you know, this movie does kind of have that same sort of manic style that the Lego Movie has at times. But this movie, you know, does have a heart to it. It really does believe in its characters. Even the, you know, these characters that get introduced later in the film that are played, you know, for a lot of laughs throughout the movie, even they know when the, you know, situation requires a moment of clarity or a moment of concern, and where they have to, you know, actually feel for the Miles Morales character. And that's really refreshing in a movie like this. That, you know, even, you know, I always hated when, you know, like you watch I Love the 80s shows and, you know, someone's just always being snarky. You just wish they'd be serious about one topic once in a while. And that's how I felt during this movie. But it pulls it off, and it's really exciting at times. The voice work is stellar. I mean, Colin mentioned Nicolas Cage, and you know that's someone that I wish people didn't even know was in this movie going in, because when he starts, you know, doing his voice work, it's absolutely tremendous. But more people need to really be given props to Jake Johnson, who plays the newer the overweight middle aged Peter Parker. He does fantastic voice work.
Yeah, he does.
In this film, he is great in it. There's a scene where he confronts someone at a dinner and is pretending to be a waiter. That is just fantastic. Just fantastic. It's manic. It's exciting. You only need, you know, unlike Mortal Engines, it only needs, you know, just a modicum of plotting to, you know, exactly, here's your MacGuffin, here's what they need, you go get it. The rest is character-driven. It's played for laughs. It's played for excitement. Please stay all the way to the end of the movie, because the laughs continue all the way till the end credits. This is a genuine surprise, and I'm really glad that that Sony continues to make good Spider-Man movies.
This was, you know, I don't know how many times we've used the word surprise, but this came out of nowhere, this movie. Like, when I first heard about it and I first saw the trailer, I was like, you gotta be kidding me, you know? A Spider-Man movie that's animated, how is this not going straight to DVD? That was what was going through my mind. And this thing, I saw it, by the way, I saw it in Navy Pier in IMAX in 3D. And if anybody can see, if you can see, it's unbelievable. Like, let me just say that. To see this thing in the IMAX 3D is just amazing. But yeah, this is one of the most fun and creative movies I've seen all year. The animation is spectacular. The voice work is great. It brings a whole fresh, you know, perspective to Spider-Man that in a completely different type of way. I mean, this is a genuinely surprising film on every level. And all that you mentioned it, Colin, every single time they introduce a new character and fly through the origin stuff cracked me up every time. I laughed every time at that. And there's some really, some very exciting action sequences. I mean, and again, as you mentioned, Colin, I mean, the animation is so beautifully all over the place, and I mean that as a compliment. It just jumps off the screen. There's just so much excitement and so many unique things that are happening that I want to go back and see, because I think I missed a few things. You know, when certain things pop up on the screen, you're like, wait a minute, what was that? And the style of animation is so mixed up and beautiful. It is an incredibly well animated movie, and there's not one frame in the movie that's not beautiful to look at. I was invested in the characters completely. I thought the father son relationship was really strong and added a bit, and added a lot of emotion to it. You know, leading up to a scene near at the end where they have sort of this bonding moment, but they don't know it. You know what I mean? Which is a really funny way to handle it, a really beautiful way to handle it. This is a movie that just came out of nowhere, and everybody does great. Jake Johnson does great work, so does Haley Steinfeld. And Nicolas Cage, every single line that Nicolas Cage has is funny. I mean, it just totally cracked me up, and the whole perspective, and you know, the kind of, because he plays the noir Spider-Man, so he's in black and he's in black and white, and he speaks in noir cliches, and it's just it's wonderful. This is a really, really terrific movie, you know, shockingly great. And again, one of the biggest surprises, we've used the word surprise now, all three of us have used the word surprise now 12 times, but that's just how incredibly surprising this movie turned out to be. I never, ever, ever expected to love an animated Spider-Man movie at this point. I just didn't, but it's great. It's great. And if you can see it in the IMAX 3D, it really does pop, man. I mean, it really is. It's pretty incredible. So I loved this movie. I thought it was great.
And when people do go see it, be sure to keep an eye whenever Spider-Man is flying through Times Square.
Yeah.
Keep an eye on everything that's on the marquees.
Oh, they're hilarious.
There.
And that's what I'm saying.
Oh, my Lord.
And that's what I'm saying. I know I missed a few of these things.
Yes.
But, yeah, I you know, what was the Shaun of the Dead one?
From Dusk Till Shaun.
Right, From Dusk Till Shaun.
There's also one involving Seth Rogen as a jockey.
Yep. Yeah, no, that's great stuff. Really, really. I mean, all the way across the board. This is just a pretty spectacular movie. So, all right. Well, guys, we're off for the next couple of weeks for the holidays. And then when we come back, we'll be back on January 7th. You guys will be down here live in the studio to do our year-end wrap-up.
Sounds great.
All right. Some of the other stuff that's coming out, I just want to mention really quickly, Welcome to Marwen opens up on Friday, and I'm hosting a screening of it at the AMC Rosemont 18 on Saturday night. So if people want to come out, I will be hosting the 7:10 screening of Welcome to Marwen.
Very cool.
And
I want to mention a movie called They Shall Not Grow Old, which is only playing as a Fathom event right now, tonight, and again on December 27th. It's a 3D movie comprised of World War I footage. It was made by Peter Jackson. It's one of the most stunning things I've ever seen, and people really need to see it in the theater in 3D while they can. I don't know why Warner Brothers and Fathom Events are only doing these little special screenings. Deserves better than that, but this is one I really feel strongly about that people should definitely go check out.
Okay. All right. That's tonight and December 27th.
Go to Fathom Events and look it up, and you'll get more information there about theaters and showtimes and all that. So.
All right. All right. Cool. All right. Colin, have a great Christmas, and we'll see you in the new year, and thanks a lot.
All right.
Okay. Eric, let's jump into the box office. Number one, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, $35.4 million. That's strong.
Yeah, it's a solid opening. I mean, compared to a lot of other superhero movies, comic book movies, it might seem low. But as animated films have kind of dominated the season, this is likely going to play very well into the holiday vacation and then some. So I think you're going to see this number is going to surprise people how high it actually gets.
I agree, because the word of mouth is going to be spectacular. I don't know. I mean, you know, this movie is going to stick around for a long time, and it should, because it's really, really good. Number two, The Mule, $17.2 million. That's more than I thought it would make.
It's about kind of what I was expecting to do. I mean, I thought that, you know, I actually thought this movie could actually do higher, because they've been advertising it pretty well. It's actually the third best opening for a movie starring Clint Eastwood.
Is that right?
If you can believe that.
Wow.
Gran Torino and Space Cowboys opened higher.
Ah. Okay.
Than that. But yeah, $17.2 million, the third highest opening for a movie starring Clint Eastwood.
Wow. All right. Number three, The Grinch, $11.5 million. It's that time of year, so obviously people are going to be going to see this thing.
Yeah, a real monster. It's still on a path for somewhere over $270 million. It's one of the big hits of the season.
Number four, Ralph Breaks the Internet, $9.5 million. It's up to $154.4 million. Is that about the same as the first one?
It's pretty much right on par with the first one. It's actually made as much as in its first 26 days as Bohemian Rhapsody did, which we're going to talk about in a second. Bohemian Rhapsody is $180 million right now, so it's going to get probably over $180 and probably get somewhere around $190. Whether it hits $200, we'll see, but it's definitely going. It should de- definitely hit what the original did, which was $189 million.
Yeah. Number five, wow, Mortal Engine, $7.5 million. I predicted that. I predicted that no one was going to care about this movie.
No, you're right, and I think people weren't even expecting it to do that low. I mean, the word all week was like, it could do under $20 million. And I was like, that seems pretty optimistic for this. You know, some people writing the headlines that it's the biggest bomb of the year, that's not entirely true. I mean, it's an abysmal opening for a $100 million production.
Yeah.
But, you know, it could still make a few bucks overseas. I wrote in my column today, I said that even if this movie made literally two cents this weekend, it still wouldn't be as big a bomb as A Wrinkle in Time and Solo were.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a loser. And it kind of shows you how hard it is to launch one of these, you know, original fantasy pictures nowadays that's not geared, you know, directly towards kids and families.
And comic books, yeah.
And comic books, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Number six is Creed 2, $5.3 million. It's up to $104 million.
Yeah, should be passing the original film by next weekend.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then number seven, it just won't stop, Bohemian Rhapsody, $4.1 million, $180 million total.
Yeah, $609 million worldwide. It is the biggest moneymaker of the holiday season right now.
Is that unbelievable?
Yeah.
Could you imagine?
And probably headed now for a Best Picture nomination.
Yeah, I know. It's insane. It's absolutely.
Because of the money.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah.
God, I hated that movie.
Garbage.
Number eight, Instant Family, $3.7 million, $60 million for your seasonal Mark Wahlberg family.
Sean Anders family
comedy.
Yeah.
Number nine, Fantastic Beasts, The Crimes of Grindelwald, $3.6 million. It's up to $151 million, but it's doing really well overseas, correct?
Yeah, it's almost to $600 million worldwide. Still down from, you know, all the previous Harry Potter movies. So Warner Brothers is going to have to do a little bit of thinking, if they're going to try and squeeze three more movies out of this.
Yeah. Number 10 is Green Book with $2.7 million. It's up to $24.6 million. I wish more people would see that.
Yeah, I mean, people are, it hasn't been falling much over the last few weeks. In the last 2 weeks, there was nothing really for it to fall from.
Yeah.
It's weird to me that, like, First Man, for example, is a movie that disappointed at the box office, and now people are saying it is a dead fish, going into the Oscars.
Yeah.
But Green Book, which has made, much less, is a strong contender for Best Picture. Yeah. That just kind of shows you, I don't know, the sort of the stigma that comes with disappointments in money, which is really just kind of shows you what a sham the Oscars really are.
Yeah. All right, well, Eric, have a great holiday, man, and I'll see you in the new year.
Thank you, man.
All
you
right,
too.
Take care, buddy. All right, there you go. We'll take a break here on 720 WGN, and the guys will return for our year-end wrap-up with the best and worst movies of the year. They'll be live in studio on January 7th. All right, we'll take a break here on 720 WGN. All right. So, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich coming up with the opening bell at 5. The great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN Radio. All right. Now, as I mentioned, my film club is having an extra screening this month. And I'm going to be hosting a screening of Welcome to Marwen, which is Robert Zemeckis' new movie, which I've seen, and it is wonderful. It's one of the best of the year. And so I'm going to host a screening of it on Saturday night. It's at 7:10, and it's at the AMC Rosemont 18. And I'm going to introduce the movie, and we'll talk about it afterwards. And so it's kind of a special extra edition of the Nick DiGilio Film Club, because I'm such a big Robert Zemeckis fan and such a fan of his new movie, and I want to talk about it and hang out with you guys, and we can watch it all together on Saturday night. So tickets are available right now, and you can go to amctheaters.com and go to amctheaters.com and go to the website, and you can pick out your seats, and we'll see you Saturday night at the 7:10 screening of Welcome to Marwen with Steve Carell and Leslie Mann. It is a wonderful, wonderful movie. Extremely exciting, very entertaining, really moving, and also funny. And it's terrific. It's just Robert Zemeckis. He's the best. And it was so great to meet him this past weekend and interview him. And Wednesday morning, we'll run the interview that Patty Vasquez and I did with Robert Zemeckis, talking about his new movie and his career. He's great. He's directed some of the greatest movies ever made. And this past year, 2018, we did 5 Zemeckis movies over the summer. We had Zemeckis Fest. So we're making this movie number 6. It'll be the 6th Zemeckis movie that I've hosted this year. And so we're going to do it Saturday the 22nd. And it's at 7:10 at the AMC Rosemont 18, formerly Movieco. We'll hang out. I'll introduce the movie. We'll talk about it afterwards. And it's the brand new Robert Zemeckis movie, and I'm really thrilled to be hosting it. Also, we have our regular film club screening. Next one is going to be on January 8th, and I will be hosting Slapshot, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. And one of the funniest movies ever made, and certainly the best movie ever made about hockey. Paul Newman, Slapshot. Tickets are on sale for that as well. $10. Parking is free. And you can reserve your tickets right now at amctheaters.com. It's Tuesday night, January 8th. The movie will start at 8 o'clock, and I will introduce it. We'll talk about it afterwards and hang out. Slapshot, one of the funniest movies ever made. And it'll be great to see it back on the big screen again. So that's coming up. And so you can get you can reserve your tickets for that as well. And for this Saturday, the 22nd, 7:10 showing of Welcome to Marwen. So those are some of the events that are coming up. And by the way, we are working on a tie-in for January 8th, the Slapshot screening for January 8th, a tie-in with the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant, which is right down the street. We had such a great time before the screening of Scrooge last month. That they had a great time. The people at the restaurant had a great time, and the management came to me and said, "Hey, we would love to do another tie-in with you guys," because we had a really big crowd at the Caddyshack restaurant, and then we all went over and watched Scrooged, and it was a really great night. And there was a 15% discount on everybody's food for the Nick D Film Club clubbers, and we're working out to try and work out another deal for the upcoming screening on January 8th. Of Slapshot. So get your tickets for Welcome to Marwen and get your tickets for Slapshot at amctheaters.com. And we will see you on Saturday for Marwen and then in January 8th for Slapshot. Okay, cool. All right, why don't we take a break here? We got the news coming up. And then after the news, it's time to talk about the top holiday toys for each year since 1920. The top holiday toys since 1920. So there you go. 312-981-7200. What were some of your favorite toys? Toys that you remember getting, that you worshipped, that you loved, that you played with all the time. Your favorite toys that you received at Christmas. And we'll go down the most popular list too. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad will call in a little bit later to tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And our phone number is 312-981-7200. We're about to jump into the topic, top holiday toys, leading back all the way to 1920. What were the top holiday toys and leading up to this year? For Christmas. And there's a few things out there. I want to jump in. What was your favorite toy growing up that you got for Christmas? And if you have kids now, what do they want? Have they requested anything is the popular toy for this year, the big toy that everybody must have? So we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. Talk and text 312-981-7200. Here is Eddie on WGN. Hi, Eddie.
Hey, man.
Hey.
Thanks, Nick. Can I thank you for your love of film?
Well, I appreciate that.
I mean that, man. I'll tell you, my favorite toy was Mr. Robot.
Mr. Robot.
Mr. Robot. Do you remember him?
Yeah.
You wind him up. It was all gears.
Mm-hmm.
So you saw the internal workings of this. And they walked. And they had like a top hat.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
Mr. Robot. Oh, you don't remember it.
Yeah, I do.
You're too young.
No, I remember it.
All right. So you do. Nick, when did it begin for you, your love of film?
When?
Please tell me. What movie did you go see as a kid? Because I'll tell you the first movie I went to see as a kid, and I was absorbed. It was Pinocchio.
Oh, okay.
And a double with Paul Bunyan, you know. And
For me, the first movie I remember seeing, it's a toss-up because it's kind of blurry, but The Love Bug, Herbie the Love Bug, and Jungle Book. Those were the two that were those were the first movies that I remember seeing.
60s that registered.
Yeah. So, but I've been a movie fan
to this point.
Well, I've been a movie fan my whole life. I mean, it's just I've always loved going to movies, and I especially.
Man, why don't you get on TCM? We got to get you on TCM.
Well, I think that there's those spots are probably taken, but I appreciate it, Eddie. Thank you for the nice phone call, and I do remember Mr. Robot. Have a great holiday season. I appreciate you listening, man. Let's see, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Dan, did you have a favorite toy when you were growing up?
The one that sticks out the most is we got Nintendo, my brother and I. You know, that was the first time I can remember asking for something really big and, you know, knowing it was a big gift and a big ask. And, you know, all my uncles and aunts pulled their money together and we got it and, you know, it played it incessantly, played it constantly. It was a yeah. important part of our childhood, you know, something we reference to this day. So that was the one.
Did you have a favorite game?
You know, it was probably Super Mario Brothers, the game that you got Super Mario Brothers and Duck Hunt with the system.
Duck Hunt.
And, yeah, you know, we played that so much, and then the, you know, second and third version of that game, and, yeah, to the point where, like I mentioned in the best man speech I gave to my brother, because we played it that much, so,
that's cool. Yeah. That's really cool. I guess I had Pong when I was growing up, and that was kind of a big deal.
Sure.
You know, I mean, obviously that was one of the, I think was Pong, I believe, was the very first sort of game thing system that you could hook up to your TV.
Right.
And, yeah, I mean, you look at that now and it's just so, you know, quaint and just like, wait a minute, kids were entertained by that? By like two sticks and a ball that was bouncing? That's it?
But it's still kind of like there's elements of that today where you're still kind of like following along and playing along. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, Pong was a big deal. I remember enjoying that very much. And the other game that you could play on that I preferred was Breakout, where you would hit you would bash the little dot ball and it would knock bricks out and bounce back and forth and back and forth. And so that was Breakout. That was the really cool Pong game was Breakout. But yeah, I remember getting Pong. But the toys that when I was a kid. Like Carl Amari was mentioning a little bit earlier when we were talking, but before our show started, he mentioned G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe was huge for me. You know, the action figures. This, and I'm talking about the real G.I. Joes. You know, full size G.I. Joe with the lifelike hair and the scar and all that stuff, and the kung fu grip. That I think my generation was, you know, we were way into G.I. Joes at that juncture. We had I had the G.I. Joe, you know, the Jeep. I had the headquarters. The headquarters was the coolest thing ever. That was a really, I remember I got that for Christmas too, and that was a gift that I just went nuts over. The G.I. Joe headquarters, which had everything, you know, in there, and it folded out, you know, it was just unbelievably cool. That was one of my favorites. And then I, you know, my parents, you know, I'm an only child, so they gave my parents, you know, did, you know, they purchased what they could. We didn't have a lot of dough growing up, but they did spend a lot of money on me at Christmas. I remember, you know, being an only child. But yeah. So I think the G.I. Joe, the G.I. Joe, particularly the headquarters, that was one of the coolest Christmas toy gifts I've ever gotten. Well, let's go back 1920. If you guys are interested in a specific year, and you want to jump in here, if you have a specific year that you would like to know the top holiday toy of that year, maybe the year of your birth, or maybe the year that you were maybe 10 or 11, which would mean that maybe that was a toy that you got. So if you want to pick out a specific year, and I will tell you what the top holiday toy was that year, and it goes back to 1920. So if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Talk or text. If you want a specific year to know what the toy is, I'll let you know what it is. 312-981-7200. And if you just want to reminisce about some of your favorite toys and some of your favorite Christmas gifts, 312-981-7200. So back in 1920, kicking off this whole article, is Raggedy Ann. The estimated retail price of Raggedy Ann was a dollar back in 1920. Originally a book character, Raggedy Ann was created by a prolific political cartoonist named Johnny Gruhl. By 1920, two signature handmade dolls, Raggedy Ann and her brother Raggedy Andy, were sold alongside the book. The result was a meteoric success on all fronts. Many myths surround the conception of Raggedy Ann, which is quite fitting given the character's storybook origins. So if you're going back to 1920, it's all about Raggedy Ann. So 1921, the Lincoln Logs. Estimated retail price, 50 cents to a dollar. 1921, Lincoln Logs. John Lloyd Wright, son to famous architect Frank Lloyd Wright, invented Lincoln Logs after noticing a foundation of interlocking beams on a Tokyo hotel that his father had designed. The earliest Lincoln Logs used redwood and employed various colors for the roof. To this day, it's not clear whether they were named actually inspired by Abraham Lincoln or whether it was due to Frank Lloyd Wright's original middle name, which is Lincoln. So there you go. Good old Lincoln Logs got popular in 1921. Here's Trucker Rich. Hey, Rich.
Hey, good evening, Nick.
Hey.
I was born in 56, but starting like in 1960 when I was four, my parents bought me an electric train set.
Oh, yeah.
And every year they would add something to it, more track or a building, more cars, what have you.
Sure, sure.
And I'd probably still have it today, and it would probably be worth a lot of money if I hadn't have seen the Addams Family on TV.
With
Adams Gomez blowing up the electric train.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, okay, sure.
You know, run them up the, you know, make a ramp and run them into the wall or
you're
something,
right.
You know, or two of them coming to the same side, you know.
Right. Yeah. Good old Adams Family right there.
Yep.
All right, Rich.
All right.
Take care.
A good evening, Nick.
All right, you too, buddy. Take care.
Bye.
Yeah. You see, Dan, I think there's something generational about how destructive some people are with their toys.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was very destructive with my toys and, you know, like would smash them into my friend's head and stuff like that. That was always good. I don't know what it was. I have no idea what was in the water at that time. Here's Tim on WGN. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Nick. How you doing, man?
All right, man. What's up?
All right. Go from Trucker Rich to Trucker Tim.
All right.
I think I listen to you as much as he does, I think.
I appreciate that.
I have a birthday on December 28th, so I can't remember if I got this gift as a birthday or a Christmas present because I, you know, at some point it became one as like Merry Birthmas.
Yeah, you know, yeah, sure, sure.
But it was, and I appreciate how much my parents must have spent on this thing. So it was like a mini John Deere tractor, and the thing was a cast iron, basically riding toy.
Sure.
And with the plastic wheels and, you know, plastic steering wheel, and it was really, really solid, and what was so much fun about it, I think I took it out in the snow after I got it and was riding around, and then it sort of got pushed to the back of the garage, and then, you know, time goes by, and now I have three kids of my own, and, you know, they're 11, 9, and 8, and they've been riding that thing for the last 5, 6, 7 years.
It's so amazing.
I know, 40-some years has gone by. For about 40 years, and my kids even still like it today with all the fancy electronic toys and all the other cool, you know, the fun games on their iPhones and whatnot. But yeah, they just love to get on the tractor and just how to ride around the yard sometimes. So it's good fun.
That's really amazing that those things, because that's when they built the toys to last.
Oh man, you could smash that thing into the walls at full speed, and nothing would happen.
Yeah,
to it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. All right, Tim, thanks, man.
All right, take care, Nick.
All right, buddy. See you there. There you go. Again, you can smash, Dan, you get more important thing. You can smash it into the wall.
There you go.
That's very important to be as destructive as possible with your toys. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. Again, if you want a specific year, I can tell you what the top toy for the holiday was that year. If you want to jump in here, either text or talk at 312-981-7200. 1922 were Tinker Toys. 59 cents was the estimated retail price for Tinker Toys, consisting of various wheels, rods, and pulleys. The original Tinker Toys came in a fun mailing tube and garnered additional distinction as a result. After an initially slow rollout, the creative construction set would appear under nearly every Christmas tree in America by the 1920s. I got Tinker Toys when I was a kid. They still have those. I still think you can get Tinker Toys. I wonder, this is another thing, is how would today's kids react to some of these old toys, these old school toys? Would they find them amusing? Would they think they were boring? I don't know. Tinker Toys. I wonder what today's youth in 2018 would think of Tinker Toys. If you put some Tinker Toys in front of them, what would they do? They would go right back to their phone. That's probably what they would do. Anyway, 312-981-7200, reminiscing here about our favorite toys from Christmas past and the most popular toys of each year going back to 1920. And once again, if you want a specific year, 312-981-7200. Hey, welcome back, everybody. How's it going? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And there you go. It's Monday, 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And we're having some fun here talking about the top holiday toys. I have the stories behind all the top holiday toys for each year going back to 1920. And if you guys want to reminisce about some of your favorite toys that you got for Christmas, 312-981-7200. Or if you want to know what was a popular toy for a specific year, I've got that information right here, and we're just having some fun talking holiday toys. 312-981-7200. Bunch of texts came in. We'll get to those in a second. Let's go to the phones. Here's Cindy on WGN. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I'm a geezer of 85 now, but I'll never forget when I was a little bitty kid. We lived around the block from that settlement house on Noble and Augusta, run by a grand dam named Harriet Vidim. At any rate, my mother used to go there for clubs, and they used to roll bandages and make toys and things for the kids and do social stuff. At any rate, this one Christmas, she gave me this toy. It was just a little stuffed animal, a little blue gingham elephant named Pee-wee with floppy ears and floppy arms and legs and stuff and the trunk sticking out. No, I thought it was the cutest thing. I named him Pee-wee, and I'd walk around and play with Pee-wee and have the best old time. And this one day I'm standing out in front of the house, and I look down the block, and here's these two kids come along, and they went up to this other little kid and took his hat off and threw it in the street, and I thought, oh my God, they're ruffians or something. Anyway, I thought I'd better protect Pee-wee, so I stuck him in my jacket and pulled up the zipper a little bit, and there I am, a perfect foil with Pee-wee's trunk sticking out of the front of my jacket. Well, they came by and grabbed him by the trunk and twisted it and almost ripped it off. Well, I let out a shriek and went in the house. And my mother, I guess I was inconsolable. Anyway, she had to sew Pee-wee's trunk back on and put a bandage on it. And it was a heck of a long time ago, but I'll never forget little blue Pee-wee.
Yeah. That's a great story. That's a great story, Cindy.
Yeah. Okay. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye.
Take care. It's amazing how sometimes you get emotionally attached. I had a thing. This is. I think I've mentioned this on the air years ago. I had a pillow called Sad Sam, and Sad Sam was a dog. And the pillow, it was a pillow that, it was sad. If you Google Sad Sam, it'll pop up. He was a beagle. If I'm not mistaken, it was a kind of an exaggerated beagle, and the pillow was shaped like a dog, and on the front, the picture was Sad Sam, you know, like being very sad. He was a dog that was sad. And then you turned the pillow over, and it was the back of him with his tail. And I treasured Sad Sam. That was one of those things. I slept with Sad Sam every night, And then I went, and then you want to talk about being inconsolable. Sad Sam ripped. We got it ripped open, and the stuffing started to come out, and I freaked out, and my mom had to sew Sad Sam back up. And then, so Sad Sam had a big scar across his face for years, but then they got me a new Sad Sam, and I still have it. I have the Sad Sam. It's in my bedroom on my dresser. Sad Sam. I wonder if anybody else had a Sad Sam. Dan, did you ever have a Sad Sam?
I did not have a Sad Sam.
Have you? Can you Google them?
There seems to be a version available now. I don't know if it's
the same one.
The same one, or if it's a.
I'd have to look at it. I mean, immediately I would know.
Yeah.
If it was, but I think there are different types of Sad Sams.
Okay.
And I'm not really sure, but I had the, and it was just this simple little pillow, and I slept with it every night, and yeah. That I didn't get. I don't think I got that for Christmas. I just remember Sad Sam being around all the time when I was a kid. And man, was I upset when they. Oh my God! It was my cousins. They ripped Sad Sam in half, and I was crying. I remember I was crying because Sad Sam was ripped, and then we sewed him up. So
did he have a companion, Honey?
No, all I had was Sad Sam. But did he? Wait a minute, Sam had a companion.
Well, was Sam Brown?
Yeah.
Okay. There many of the posts have Sad Sam and Honey. Honey was a gray dog, same make and same type of look and everything. So.
Wait a minute. Let's see. Let me see if there's a. Oh. Okay. Yeah, I see. Now, see, he looks a little bit different. These are like stuffed dolls, right? What I'm looking at.
Correct.
Okay, this was just a pillow.
Yeah, my searches for Sad Sam pillow aren't coming up with anything.
No?
Except, like, like his face on a pillow, not necessarily a pillow made out of him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's different. This is different than the Sad Sam that I had. That's different. And it was just his face on the pillow. It was just like, the material was just like, it was like a sheet. You know what I mean? It was cloth. And they stamped his face on the pillow on the front, and then on the back was his back with his tail. But I treasured that. Man, I loved Sad Sam. All right, here is Francis on WGN. Hi, Francis.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to know what toy was popular in 1947. And also, about 1954, I had this doll. It was porcelain, and you put a key in it and wound it up, and it would walk. And I've never seen any doll like that. Since then or now.
Wow. Oh, okay. Well, 1947, Tonka trucks were the biggest.
Oh, really?
Were estimated retail price were $1. They were named after Lake Minnetonka. Tonka trucks were founded by three Minnesotans who were going into business in garden equipment manufacturing. But when they bought out a competitor and inadvertently wound up with a toy steam shovel, they took a look at making toys. And soon enough, the digger, along with the functional crane and clam, sold 37,000 units. The men ditched garden tools altogether and refocused their attention entirely on toy work vehicles for kids. And those are the Tonka trucks, 1947.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much. That's right. So interesting.
Okay, thanks,
thank
Francis.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Lake Minnetonka. That's the... Isn't that the lake that Apollonia is supposed to jump into in Purple Rain? Lake Minnetonka? That ain't Lake Minnetonka. All right. Scott sends a text that says, the Evel Knievel action figure, best gift ever. Yeah, I had the Evel Knievel. I did. 224 area code says, busy buzz buzz. Shrinky Dinks, Pottery Craft, and Shaker Maker. I'm the same age as you, Nick. I gotta love those 70s toys. Yeah, we had some fun toys back in the 70s. We'll get to that decade. The 847 area code says that caller is thinking of Mr. Machine, not Mr. Robot. Yeah, Mr. Robot is with Remy Malek. 608 area code says, my favorite toy was my radio flyer wagon. 301 area code says, in the 1960s, I got the greatest Christmas toy of my childhood, the Great Garlou. It was a reptilian upright monster that could move, bend over, and pick up things. My cousin Timmy was afraid of it. My mother hated it, and I loved it. A few years later, my mom got rid of it while I was at school. I was devastated. Happy ending, though. A few years back, my wife and kids got me one on eBay for Christmas that year. It doesn't move or bend over, but I love it just the same. The Great Garlou? See, now that sounds like something I would love. Hey, by the way, speaking of upright lizard monster reptilian, have you seen the trailer for the new Godzilla movie?
I have not.
Oh, my God. It's going to be the greatest film ever made. It's going to be the great. Ghidra's in it. Rodan is in it. Mothra's in it. Oh, man. Saw the trailer for it over the weekend. We went to go see the mule. I was more excited about that 2 minutes than anything else I saw. Oh, my God. It's going to be good. Comes out in May. I'm counting the days. All right. We got a break. Everybody hang on. 312-981-7200. Having fun here reminiscing about our favorite toys from Christmas time and talking about the biggest toys, the holidays from years past. 312-981-7200. News is next. Welcome back, everybody. How are you? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because that's what we do every Monday. Hear a joke from my dad. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're talking about the top holiday toys going back to 1920, and I have a year-by-year here description of what were the top toys, and we're talking about those. And we're also talking about your favorite toys that you remember as a kid you got for Christmas. 312-981-7200. And if you have a specific year that you're interested in knowing what the top toy was, give us a call or give us a text at 312-981-7200. Here is Elizabeth on WGN. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, how's my favorite person?
Oh, good, thank you.
You made me remember a Didi baby doll. She was all rubber before the war, and this was the Second World War. And you'd give her water, and she'd wet herself.
Oh, but sure.
But the toy that my children really loved was an Irish male, M-A-I-L. Do you know what those are?
No.
They were like the puppers that they used to have on the railroad. You'd sit on them, you'd put your feet in the front, and you'd go back and forth. And it was made out of steel. I remember purchasing it at Dispensa's Castle of Toys. Mm. And I still have all 30 of their wooden play school puzzles with all the pieces intact.
Wow.
Upstairs, and a Bozo the Clown.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff right there. The Dispensa's, man, I remember Dispensa's. That place was the best
place to go.
Yeah. All right, Elizabeth. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Okay. All right. So 312-981-7200. Let's see. We got a couple more texts here. 54574 area code wants to know what was popular in 1975. Okay, you ready for this? It was the Pet Rock. Only in the 70s, Dan. Only in the 70s would something like the Pet Rock actually sell. And it sold a lot. I had one. Estimated retail price, $3.95. Gary Ross doll supposedly thought up a Pet Rock over drinks with friends. Really? Drinks? Drinks were involved coming up with the idea for the Pet Rock? Shocking. Imagining the ideal pet as one that made no mess and required no effort. Pair that idea with clever marketing and lucky timing, and you end up with arguably the most famous, most useless product in the history of America. Indeed, even decades later, the Pet Rock stands as both a tribute to and a mockery of the perennial wonders of capitalism. Yeah. Let's see. See, that was around popular. You know what else was really popular around that time, Dan? The mood ring. You ever have a mood ring?
Nope.
Have you know what a mood ring is?
I do.
Yeah, you put the thing on, and then it changes color. The stone changes color depending on your mood, and it came with like a chart that showed you what mood or what was wrong with you depending on what color it was. That was also like really, really popular, like in the 70s. People are buying Pet Rocks and mood rings. That's what the 70s, that kind of sums up the 70s right there. here's Barb on WGN. Hi, Barb.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I was just going to say that woman with all the puzzles and things, I hope she has grandkids to enjoy them.
Yeah.
Well, when I was a year old, my mother couldn't remember if it was my first Christmas or my first birthday, I was given a little stuffed animal. It was a dog about, 8 inches tall, and it just had... It was like sitting up, but it just had short little arms and legs and little floppy kind of, silver-like ears. Anyway, that was my thing. I carried that around all the time. I slept with it. And I slept with it growing up until I was, well, I don't know. But anyway, when I was, I took a couple of college courses, and one thing was on semantics. We had to describe something so that people could picture it.
Yeah.
And I did this little thing because it was, well, it was easy to describe, and it was easy to carry to class. So anyway, that was when I was about 20. And then had kids. And my eldest is, I think, exactly your age.
Mm-hmm.
And his slight, his two-year younger brother took a liking to this little thing. I mean, anyway, he had two little sisters, and he would play with them and their stuffed animals, and he declared this one that I had as Mama Puppy. Well, it got played with a lot, and he slept with that. He was a thumb sucker, and he would rub the ears, suck the thumb and rub the ears.
Yeah.
So anyway, the thing ended up being just kind of a rag. I finally got rid of it. It kind of broke my heart.
Yeah, no, I know. You get emotionally, you get emotionally attached to those things. I mean, like I said, my Sad Sam pillow was just one of my favorite things ever. And you get emotionally attached to it. Yeah, you get a lot of memories, you know. I mean, especially if you love it so much, you sleep with it every single night during your childhood. You know, that's a big part of your childhood. It really is. Barb, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. 312-981-7200. Here is Steve from Galesburg. Hi, Steve.
Hey, my favorite when I was young was Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
Oh, sure. I had those. I loved Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
Me and my buddies could play it when it was too cold to go out and play baseball.
Yeah, and you could play it, and you always loved the sound when you knock the block off and you go, yeah.
And sometimes you didn't even have to hit it.
Yeah. Depending on how old it was. Like if your Rock'em Sock'em Robots were a few years old, they would pop up anytime.
But then in the 70s, they had this thing come out called Simon.
Sure, that was one of the first electronic games.
Yeah, and I was hypnotized by that.
Yeah, I had Simon. I thought it was great. I thought Simon was really a cool game. I know they still sell Simon. I think Simon's a pretty big seller to this day. Yeah. All right, Steve.
I don't need it again.
No, okay. All right, Steve. Thank you.
All right, thanks.
All right. We got some more texts here. Let's read a few of these. 847 area code. My favorite doll was called Chatty Cathy. Oh, yes, Chatty Cathy. It was a pull-string talking doll. It was my favorite, and I got it in 1954. There was Chatty Cathy, and then, you know, we had somebody already call in about a doll that, you know, a baby doll that wets itself. There used to be Betsy Wetsy. Betsy Wetsy and Chatty Cathy. John says the reason G.I. Joe had a scar was because they needed something to make it unique for the copyright. Otherwise, they couldn't copyright just a general army man. Oh, okay. Dave in Monroe, Wisconsin says my games were Donkey Kong, Pac-Man, and Monopoly. Paul says, how about plastic models? We would melt them and blow them up. See, Dan? That's what you got to do. Melt stuff, blow it up.
And then hit people with it.
And then hit people. Smack somebody upside the head with it. What was in 1961? 1961, Slip and Slide. The original estimated retail price was $8.95 per box of six. As one might expect, the Slip and Slide has relatively dangerous origins. In 1960, an upholsterer by the name of Robert D. Carrier came home to find his son and his son's friend sliding down a wet pavement of their driveway. Drawing on his work with synthetic fabrics, Carrier created a plastic slide for the kids to put down over hard surfaces for a slicker, presumably safer experience. The Slip and Slide. Okay, Jesse requested 1974 and 1996. 1974 was the skateboard. Estimated retail price, $20 to $60. Skateboarding began in 1958 when people attached roller skates wheels to a board in order to sidewalk surf. No, that's not true. You know why, Dan? You know why that's not true?
Why is that not true?
Because Marty McFly invented it in 1955. I think people ought to understand that. It wasn't until the early 70s that the creation of urethane wheels to smooth out an otherwise bumpy ride that skateboards really found their enduring stride. 1996, how can you forget this? Tickle Me Elmo. The original estimated retail price was $29.99. Tyco Toys cashed in on Elmo's infectious laugh by giving the popular Sesame Street character a doll of its own in 1996. What they didn't anticipate were the hysteric levels of demand after the toy sold out in the midst of the holiday shopping season. During the Tickle Me Elmo craze, shoppers engaged in physical battle. Yeah, that was the big one. And I'm guessing in 1983, if I look up 1983, it's going to be the Cabbage Patch Kid. Yep, Cabbage Patch Kids. Because that was when people went nuts over those Cabbage Patch Kids, man. My friend Scott Oaken used to work at Venture. He was a manager at Venture, and he was there that season when the Cabbage Patch Kids were released. And so they had people waiting outside the store right at the beginning of the morning, like 6 o'clock in the morning, like tons of people waiting outside. And as soon as they opened up the doors, people ran full speed to the toy department to try and grab a Cabbage Patch Kid. And Scott said he saw women like punching each other over these dolls, like literally getting into fist fights. You know, adult women just smacking people around in order to get these dolls. It was ridiculous. The Cabbage Patch Kids craze, ridiculous. So, all right, everybody hang on. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Top holiday toys from the year 1920 on. And if you have a specific year that you're wondering about, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And we're reminiscing about some of your favorite toys, too. Hey, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. That's what's coming up. And coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and we're reminiscing about our favorite toys during the holiday season here. And I have the top holiday toys from each year going all the way back to 1920. And if you are curious about a specific year, 312-981-7200. And if you'd like to know what that top toy is. Oh, look at this. It's our good friend Eddie Volkman. Eddie, how are you, man?
Good. What's up, Nick?
Hey, what's happening?
Our toy growing up, my brother, who was like just like a year older than I was the Whammo Air Blasters. do you remember? Do you remember those at all?
Remind me, because I remember, I know Whammo made a bunch of products that I liked.
Well, the Whammo Air Blaster was this, had this conical thing on the front. You just pumped it up several times, and it was like a big pistol, and it just shot a puff of air. And the TV commercial showed a little boy shooting a couple of the little targets that came with it. But the biggest selling point was then you saw him sitting on like a staircase, and his older like teenage sister was like sitting on the couch with a boyfriend, and the kid shoots it, and makes her hair go foof, and she turns around with this horribly annoyed look. So that was the major selling point. So it would shoot like a concentrated blast of air,
right,
like 15 to 20 feet. Well, so my brother and I got him, and of course, being boys, you know, we had to come up with other uses. So we had pet hamsters, and we'd launch the hamsters like about 5 or 6 feet onto it. You know, a soft landing
area, like a
pillow or something. And then in the summertime, we later found out that if we took the ashes from the grill out in the backyard, from the Weber grill, put them in those things, you could make a fabulous blast of ash smoke. And so we walk around and blast the other neighborhood kids, including a buddy of yours two doors down, George Tarzis.
Oh, is that right,
George? he was so traumatized he had to open a restaurant. I don't know.
That's great.
The Whammo Air Blaster.
All right, Eddie.
Yeah.
Take care, buddy.
All right.
Thanks for listening. Right. I appreciate it. There you go. There you go. That's Eddie Volkman, everybody. Torturing our good friend George Karzis, who owns the greatest restaurant on the planet, the Gale Street Inn. Forgot that they were neighbors. That's funny. Nancy's on WGN. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Oh, Nick, I love your show.
Thank you.
I tell you that for years.
Thank you.
My first Christmas gift I absolutely remember was in 1963. I was 11 years old. I got a little record player, and it was so cute. It was pink and white.
Uh-huh.
It was like a little suitcase, you know, it had a handle on it,
yep.
And you could carry it all around. But with it, I remember I got three record albums with it, only three. And one was Blue Velvet by Bobby Vinton.
Mm-hmm.
The second one was Sugar Shack by Jimmy Gilmer and the Fireballs. And those two both came out in 63. And the last one I got was To Wish You a Merry Christmas by Harry Belafonte. And that came out in 58. And I know those had to be my mom's absolute favorite songs and records.
Because
she wouldn't give them up for years. Even after I moved out and got married, she would keep them. She wouldn't give them up. And I finally got them after making an issue. But, oh, my God, I'll never forget. I played that record player for years and years until it finally broke off.
I had one of those. I had one of those, too, Nancy. It was, the portable record player that would close like a suitcase.
Oh, yeah.
And it had a handle, and you would lift up the lid and then plug it in and play your records. I had one of those, too. I think a lot of people.
Did you?
Yeah, I think a lot of people growing up in a specific time had those, the little record player that would with the little case. I played it all the time.
Yeah, and I doubt if yours was pink and white.
No, it wasn't. It was not pink and white, but it was the same kind of product though. So,
yeah. Now, what was a favorite toy in 63?
63
for Christmas.
Let me.
1963.
All right, let me find out here. I'll look it up for you. 1963 was the Easy Bake Oven.
Oh, yes.
The Easy Bake Oven.
I missed out on that.
Yeah,
I never got that, but I loved it. I wanted it, but I love the record player even more, I think.
Got it.
But,
okay.
Yeah, well, I remember Easy Bake Oven. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Nancy.
Thank you so much, Nick.
Yeah, bye. Easy Bake Oven estimated a retail price of $15 for the Easy Bake Oven, which is essentially just a light bulb. Wait. See what it says here. It says a small working oven for kids might sound like a brilliant idea, but the Easy Bake Oven did invoke some safety concerns among parents upon its 1963 debut. To address those worries, toy company Kenner installed two 100-watt bulbs as a heating source to reduce the chance of burns. So there it is, 1963. Here's Bob on WGN. Hi, Bob. Bob?
Hello?
Yeah, you're
right. Hello?
Yeah,
I was born in 1941, and I was curious what was popular that year.
1941, that's also the year my dad was born. It would be the beach ball.
Oh, okay.
Beach ball was the most popular toy in the holidays in 1941, and it was the estimated retail price, 5 cents. 5 cents
for
a beach ball. There you go.
In 1947, I received an Erector set. I haven't heard that mentioned.
Erector set has got to be here somewhere because, those were very popular. I had an Erector set, too, when I was a kid.
Really?
We'll find out what year that the Erector set. 1924,
okay.
Erector set. 1924. The original retail price was $1 to $10 for the Erector set, depending on the size.
Well, I played with that thing for years and lost all the little parts to it. All I had left was the electric motor, and I used to mess around with that.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Bob. Okay, take care. Hey, the beach ball was popular for the year my dad was born, 1941, was the beach ball. How about, let's see. Here we go. The A.C. Gilbert chemistry sets became popular in 1923. Estimated value $1.50 to $10. In a rather stunning example of how times have changed, magician A.C. Gilbert's wildly popular chemistry sets that were introduced that year included flammables and explosives among their components. The 1923 version was aimed exclusively at young boys, and decades would pass before unisex sets were introduced to the market. I had a chemistry set. You know, that's the thing. We've talked about this before, Dan. it's amazing that people around my generation or a little bit older are survived the childhood with the toys that we had. Like a chemistry set? Hey, I wonder what's going to happen here. It might blow up. We could drink some liquid here.
Maybe that's why you guys were so violent.
That might be. The toys influenced us. No, I mean, seriously, there were some dangerous, you know, I mean, there were dangerous toys out there, you know? We were talking about, you know, these stuff that were made of steel. That you would smash them into the wall. Yeah, so. All right, what was your favorite holiday toy? 312-981-7200 is the phone number. And if you're looking for a specific year of what was the big toy that year, 312-981-7200. We're coming up on the news here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Monday morning. That means in a little while my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. And we've been talking about the top holiday toys for each year dating back to 1920. And if you want to find out a specific year, what was the big toy that year, 312-981-7200. And if you... I want to reminisce a little bit about some of your favorite toys that you got when you were a kid for Christmas. 312-981-7200. Hey, Airborne. Dan. Nobody gets that but the real genius fans out there. And I don't know, I have to tell you, I don't know why we attached to that. I have no idea why we latched onto that. My friends and I latched onto that particular line. Hey, Airborne. That's... let me ask you this. Does Emily want anything specific this year?
She's in the princess mode, so yeah, so everything, I mean, she wants everything that is every commercial that airs, but in terms of like the popular stuff, no, it's just, you know, the, you know, a Cinderella doll.
Yeah. She's like, the princess thing is big.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, she's going to be four, right?
Right.
May?
Correct.
You know, it's funny. How is she doing with the calendar?
Oh, the she's advent forgotten calendar. About it. So.
Oh, she has?
Yeah. So we haven't brought it back up.
Okay. Well, who's eating the chocolate?
Nobody. We're hiding it.
Oh, I see.
I'm sure the day will come when we're going to have, you know, 10 pieces that day. So.
I used to love those things when I was a kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, those are great. Those are really great. And that's something that, man, how long have they been around?
Oh, yeah, forever.
I mean, that's just, that's got to be a tradition that goes back way, way back.
Sure.
You know? But, yeah. So I didn't know whether she wanted something specific. But,
yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, she really liked the spirit, the horse spirit from the Dreamers movie. So, you know, there are specific things she's asked for, but nothing, yeah. You know, that's like out of the crazy or out of the question.
Yeah. Got it. So what, I was watching the show on Friday night. It's on Friday nights. It's on ABC. It's called Child Support.
Okay.
Have you seen this?
No.
Okay. Fred Savage. It's a game show. Fred Savage is the host, okay? And so what happens is a contestant comes on, and they have to, you know, it's your basic, like, you answer these questions, and you can get up to $200,000, blah, blah, blah. And it's a they throw out a trivia question, and it's, you know, it's set up like, you know, you're, you know, millionaire. It looks like that. The set's all lit up and stuff. But the trick is, or the twist is that you answer a question, and if you get it wrong... then they go to a room full of kids with Ricky Gervais in the room. So Ricky Gervais is in a room with a bunch of kids, and then he asks the kids the question, and if the kids get it right, they save you so that you're still in the game. So, and I can't remember the specific question, but I thought of you immediately. I thought of you and your family immediately because it was a question about Moana. And I know you would have gotten it completely.
Right.
And the woman, you know, the adult woman got it wrong. But the kids immediately, like every single one of the kids, got it right. And I wish I could remember what the question was, but I don't. I don't remember. But I thought of you. And anytime Moana comes up,
sure.
I think of you and your family.
Yep.
So, all right, let's see. I'm going to go to the 70s here when was my childhood here and see what we got for that era. Why don't we start with 1970? Let's start with that. I was five in 1970. So the Nerf ball, that was the big one for the holidays in 1970. For those of you who are around my age, you'll remember a lot of these toys. The Nerf ball, originally the estimated retail price was $2. Made from, quote, non-expanding recreational foam and marketed as, quote, the world's first indoor ball, the Nerf ball was an instant smash for Parker Brothers. More than 4 million units sold in the first year alone. Similar products followed. Eventually, the Nerf football took the crown for the best-selling toy of the Nerf's lineup. I had a lot of Nerf balls. I had a Nerf football. Did you ever have Nerf balls, Dan?
Oh, yeah. They were
everywhere, right?
Yeah, three boys.
Yeah. Let's see here. Weebles. Yeah, anybody remember Weebles, Dan?
I know of them, but I never personally encountered them.
And the catchphrase, which was Weebles wobble, but they won't fall down. $6.58 were the estimated retail price. That's pretty specific. Weebles were a family of egg-shaped plastic figurines distinguished by bright colors and kinetic, somewhat hypnotic movements, bolstered by the catchphrase, Weebles wobble, but they won't fall down. The toys were a must-have among kids in the early to mid-70s. I never had the Weebles because I don't think I cared. It didn't really strike me as, you know, like a selling point was, oh, look, it's a egg-shaped thing that won't fall. I never really got into that. 1972, Uno, the card game. Merle Robbins, a barbershop owner and card game enthusiast, was convinced he could improve upon the game of Crazy Eights. The result was Uno, which Robbins initially sold through local businesses and his own barber shop. Robbins licensed the rights in 1972 to a funeral parlor owner in Illinois, who took Uno to the national stage with spectacular success. Wow, that's interesting background on Uno. A barbershop owner and a funeral parlor owner. That's great. 1973, another one from my childhood, Shrinky Dinks. Somebody mentioned that one already. Original estimated retail price not available. Shrinky Dinks, thin sheets of decorated plastic that shrunk down and hardened after baking inside an oven, were marketed as pure magic upon their release in 1973. Of course, the real explanation was polystyrene plastic, which hosts polymer chains that straighten out when heat rolled and cooled. Another real safe choice for kids. That's what you want your kids to do. You want your kids to put plastic in the oven. That's what you want. That's the kind of fun that we had in the 70s. Was putting plastic into an oven. Let's see. 74 we did already. That was the skateboard. 75 was the pet rock. 76, this was a big one. Dan, this was a big one. Stretch Armstrong. I don't even want to explain how crazy we loved Stretch Armstrong. $5 was the estimated retail price. You could pull, twist, throw, beat, bend Stretch Armstrong, but you couldn't break him. Made from a blend of plastic, rubber, and gel, the iconic figure would stretch his limbs up to four times their normal size. That was a very big toy when I was a kid. That was a real popular toy, the Stretch Armstrong. 1977, the Atari 2600 game system, the estimated retail price, $199.99. So $200, that's a pretty penny in 1977. That's a lot of money. The Atari 2600 was absolutely crucial to the development of gaming. The product offered streamlined playability with a slew of great titles like Frogger, Pac-Man, and Space Invaders. The console wasn't the first to bring gaming into the home, but it was arguably the most important early catalyst for what would eventually become the home gaming revolution. Be 1977. 1978, Star Wars action figures. Estimated retail price $3 and up. Star Wars today is the bar for which other franchises currently aspire, but the movie's initial success in 1977 caught virtually every industry by surprise, including the toy industry. To account for the sudden demand of the merchandise, toy company Kenner hastily released a series of puzzles and games to uneven results. However, as soon as the 3.75-inch action figures of Luke Skywalker, R2-D2, Chewbacca, and Princess Leia hit shelves in 78, Star Wars merchandise became as popular as the film itself. All right. Bunch of texts have come in. 312-981-7200. Joe says, on Christmas 1963, I received a lie detector game by Mattel. I had a lot of fun with that game. A lie detector game? Wow. 630 area code says, I got an Aurora slot car set from Santa in 1963 Christmas. My brothers and I played it constantly. We added more track and cars over the 10 years. It was the best toy ever. Dave said, the best toy was the $6 million man. I still have it today. Yeah, that was a big deal. The $6 million man where you can, like, he had, like, you could look through his eye because he had a bionic eye. There was a hole in the back of the doll's head. And you could look through it. Yeah, that was a big one. That was huge. I remember the Christmas I got that. It had to be in, the, like, 76, maybe. 76, 77 when I got the $6 million man. That was a big deal. Patricia, I'm 82, and my favorite was my Shirley Temple doll. 773 area code says pivot pool, Spirograph, and etch a sketch. I had the Spirograph and the etch a sketch. 608 area code says what about silly putty? Silly putty. Yes. Yeah. Silly Putty was the stuff that you would copy, comics with it. That was the people. I think people sometimes get Play-Doh confused with Silly Putty. Different, very, very different things. Both fun though. So, all right, let's do some weather here, and then we'll come back. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. Here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we've been reminiscing about some of our favorite holiday toys. And I've got the top holiday toy for each year going all the way back to 1920. So if there's a specific year that you're curious about, I can let you know what was the number one toy for that year. Let's see. More texts here. What were popular toys in 1956, 1990, and 1993? 1956, it was Play-Doh. Original retail price, 99 cents for four. After hearing from teachers that kids were turned off by the rigidity of modeling clay, a man named Joe McVicker began sending soft wallpaper cleaning product to schools as a substitute material. By 1956, that substitute had a name all its own, Play-Doh. The product had been a grade school staple ever since. 1990 was the other one that I wanted to know. Teenage Mutant Ninja action figures. Original retail price, $3.99 and up. Now, Dan, were you a Teenage Mutant Ninja action figure?
I was indeed, yes.
Did you have a favorite Ninja Turtle?
Donatello.
The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles rose to fame on the back of a massively popular animated series about witty crime fighters with a passion for New York pizza. By the time their 1990 live-action movie dropped, the Turtles had utterly conquered the youth market with best-selling toys and box office numbers to show for it. It's just such a weird concept.
Yeah.
You know, you look back and go, how did that become a thing? Who came up with that idea?
Yeah.
They live in the sewer.
Right.
They're turtles. They're giant turtles. They know ninja. They're like ninja. They know, you know, martial
named
arts.
Named after Renaissance painters.
Yeah, named after Renaissance
mentored
painters.
Mentored by a rat.
Yeah. Weird. And they like pizza. 1993 was the Super Soaker. Originally estimated $10 to $50. $50? You can spend $50 on a Super Soaker? Get a hose. When not helping NASA with their Galileo mission to Jupiter, nuclear engineer Dr. Lonnie Johnson was home working on a heat pump that could use vaporized water pressure instead of hazardous Freon. When the pump sent a stream of water across the room, Johnson pivoted toward creating a high-powered water blaster instead. He built a prototype out of PVC pipe, and an empty soda bottle. He called it the Power Drencher, which used an air pressure chamber to pump water from a reservoir. Following a few necessary tweaks, though, the Super Soaker was born. People still blast each other with those things? The Super Soaker? Let's see. 847 area code. My favorite was the Cuddly Dudley dog that the Tribune offered, I think, in the 60s. I wish I still had it. Cuddly Dudley. Yeah. Good old Ray Rayner would visit Cuddly Dudley every morning. Cuddly Dudley would read letters from viewers. Yeah. Let's see. 773 area code. I liked the G.I. Joe copy Action Jackson and the Marshall Brodeen magic set. Everybody had the Marshall Brodeen magic set. You had the magic set. We had the magic cards, Marshall Brodeen. Dan, you are you too young to remember who Marshall Brodeen is?
I knew who he was. I didn't have the magic set.
And he was Wizzo. He was Wizzo on Bozo. Doo-dee-doo-dee-doo-dee-doo-dee-doo. Cuddly Dudley. I remember when Ray Rayner used to go visit Cuddly Dudley at Cuddly Dudley's house. And he would put the letter in front of Cuddly Dudley. You know, he would take a letter and he would put it in front of Cuddly Dudley. And then Cuddly Dudley would look down and he would read from, you know, whoever the kid was who wrote in. And I remember as a kid, I was like, how's Cuddly Dudley reading that? Not knowing that the guy who did the voice for Cuddly Dudley had a different letter in front of him that he was reading. And that was a fake letter. Not a fake letter, but, you know, a distraction letter. So it looks like Cuddly Dudley, who was just a doll, a stuffed doll, a puppet, looked like he was reading. And I remember I was like, wow, how's he reading that? Because I was a dumb kid. The Marshall Brodeen set that was the best. 847 area code says, I still have my original Weeble. My one-year-old looks at me like I'm crazy when I try to entice him to play with it. He just wants the iPad. Oh, man. A one-year-old wants the iPad. Like, I'm not going to play with a Weeble. What is it? 815 area code says, mine was called Duck Hunt Plastic Darts. Dad and I had a great time with it. We got bored trying to hit the ducks, so we started picking off glass ornaments on the tree. Mom was not happy. Oh, it's nice that the dad gets involved in that. Get no excuse, man. All right. 1979, Simon, as we mentioned before, it was $24.95, an electronic toy which tested your memory by playing color patterns that you had to play back in sequence. It was unveiled at Studio 54, of all places. It was thereafter a staple in just about every suburban toy chest in America. So, Studio 54, that's a... 1979, Studio 54 was a den of sex and drugs, and you're going to... Here's a nice toy for everybody. You could play it in between doing bumps. 1980, the Rubik's Cube. The original retail value price was $1.99. Hungarian designer Erno Rubik, in 1974, designed a 3D geometric puzzle called Magic Cube. By 1980, Rubik's nifty contraption was in the hands of an Ideal Toy and Novelty Company, which renamed it Rubik's Cube. The puzzle was an instant success, selling 100 million units with the first 2 years alone. In the time since, the sphere of competitions, books, and imitators has emerged. It's also featured in Spider-Man in the Spider-Verse, the Rubik's Cube. It completely baffles Spider-Man Noir. It completely baffles. He doesn't understand the Rubik's Cube at all. One of the many, many funny things that Nicolas Cage gets to do in that movie, which is, we gave a great review, by the way. Eric and Colin and I all rave about the new Spider-Man animated movie. It's just great. Shockingly good. Like, had no idea that it would even be in the vicinity of being that good. It is such a terrific movie. 1981 was the He-Man action figure. That was your big toy in 1981. Estimated retail price $4.99. He-Man and the Masters of the Universe were introduced in 81 as a series of action figures who could throw punches by way of pull and release mechanisms. In an additional show of strength, each Masters of the Universe action figure was nearly 2 inches larger than Kenner's Star Wars or Hasbro's G.I. Joe action figures. And then 1982, it was My Little Pony. The original estimated price, $3 and up, giving Barbie a literal run for her money that year, was Hasbro's My Little Pony, a range of small vinyl horses with long, bright, and groomable hair. Each pony also came with an adorable name and a unique emblem branded on its backside. My Little Pony. All right. All right, and then, of course, 83, we mentioned the Cabbage Patch Kids. It was insane. The estimated retail price, $40 for a Cabbage Patch Kid. Defined by their doughy bodies and large round heads, Cabbage Patch Kids took the world by storm after appearing on a TV show called Real People in 1980. That storm turned into a full-blown monsoon by 1983 as desperate parents shoved, scratched, grabbed, elbowed, and punched their way down the toy aisle in hopes of snagging the popular doll before Christmas. Known as the Great Cabbage Patch Craze, the incident would later inspire the movie Jingle All the Way with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sinbad. Well, thank you for that inspiration. All right. Yeah, and that's not an exaggeration, by the way. People went nuts over these Cabbage Patch dolls. If you're too young to remember, it was complete insanity. Complete. Okay. Let's take a break here for the news, and we'll come back. We'll talk more toys and what year was the popular toy that year and all that stuff. 312-981-7200. All right. Hey, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich will have the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday, and that means in just a few minutes, my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. And we've been talking about toys, holiday toys, and what were the big ones. we've been going year by year. I've got all the big toys all the way through back to 1920 through now, through today. We're talking about some of your favorite toys as well. 312-981-7200. Here's Brian on WGN. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Brother Nick. Good morning.
Morning.
I had a question for you. Do you remember that stuff that used to come in like a tube, and it smelled like adhesive, and it was multicolored, and it came with an aluminum tube, and you put it at the end of it, and blew the giant bubble?
Yep.
Remember that?
Yep, I absolutely
remember. It was made by Whammo, and I can't remember it.
I can't remember the name of it either, but it was toxic as hell. And you could, you know, like you,
oh, yeah.
You would put this goo on the end of this straw, and then you would blow up this like multicolored ball made with some sort of toxic like plastic substance. But the other thing is that you could, what you do is if you would blow into that goo and the ball would grow. You could also inhale. So
yeah.
you can inhale all that toxin back into your lungs, that's again. Again, yet another, you know, I can't believe we're not dead toy from the 70s.
Yep, and then the aluminum tube later on we use for doing cocaine, so there you go.
All right, Brian, thanks, buddy.
Hey, one more thing. You know the Cabbage Patch? Well, the same Christmas, the biggest toy for boys was GoBots. You couldn't find those anywhere.
Oh, GoBots. Yeah, that's true.
That was huge.
Yeah, GoBots, yes. That's true. Yep. All right, Brian, thanks, buddy.
Hey, no problem. Thanks. Okay. Have a good Christmas.
Thanks, buddy. Take care. You too. I can't remember the name of the product that Brian is talking about, but it came in like a tube, and it would be like this goo, this multicolored goo that was made of some sort of soft, like rubbery substance, and you would stick it on the end of a straw and then blow through the straw to blow up a big ball. And then you would clinch, you would cinch the end, and you could play around with this thing, and it was nice and toxic too. Then you could inhale all that lovely toxin into your lungs. This is how we had fun in the 70s. Callers are saying it's the incredible elastic bubble plastic. That's it. That's it, Dan. The incredible elastic bubble plastic. Oh, man. Let's see. 815 area code says, how about the Slinky? Yeah, I enjoyed the Slinky. Kind of a one-note toy, but it was fun. 773 area code says, I loved Color Forms. Yeah, Color Forms were fun. They were. 773 area code says, don't break the ice, Mr. Potato Head, Light Bright, Beautiful Chrissy, Operation, and Kerplunk. Those are all classics. Yeah. Don't break the ice. Those were fun games. Remember Cootie? Dan, you probably don't remember Cootie.
I do not.
No. You know, Mary's around my age. I bet Mary had some of the same toys. Is she available for a little chat, perhaps?
She just needs a minute to grab her headphones.
Get her headphones, and we'll get her thoughts on there. Because Mary and I are around the same age. So she probably has the same kind of memories about the toys of that era.
Good morning. Real quick, second group of collagen tickets to let you know is the super elastic bubble plastic, not incredible elastic.
Oh, it's super elastic bubble plastic. Yeah. Okay. You remember that, Mary?
What year was that?
It was in the 70s.
Oh, yeah. That was, I don't think I remember. That was more of a guy thing.
Yeah.
That was, one of my brothers might have had that.
Yeah, and it was also, you know, like to inhale some really dangerous toxins, too.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did that. We had the Nerf, everything Nerf.
Everything Nerf? Had.
Yeah, my brother was 2 years older than me, and so he would just shoot me all day long and, you know, shoot at the ornaments. And it was like my mother was, take it outside. I go, well, it's an inside toy, really.
Yeah, that's what the whole Nerf
that was
thing
the whole
was supposed
point
to be. Did you have a favorite toy?
Oh, yeah. I had so many toys. Yeah. But, you know, my Madame Alexander doll that I got, Bridget, I don't remember what year it was, but it was in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Madame Alexander doll?
Yes. They're dolls that are just beautifully made to look like real, real babies.
Mm-hmm.
And they do. And I still have Bridget.
Oh,
so
boy.
My son-in-law cannot stand dolls.
Yeah.
You know, he gets freaked out by
sure.
movies with dolls. So I plant Bridget in various places when he comes over.
That's awesome.
And I torment Johnny with Bridget.
That's awesome.
She's great. I had the Easy Bake. Spinning Tops. Do you remember Spinning Tops?
Oh, sure.
That game. I loved that. I was mesmerized.
And you would like have to knock the other one out.
Everything down.
Yeah.
I loved that game. Yeah. I loved board games. I had a lot of board games.
Did your kids have specific wants? Like were you part of the Cabbage Patch insanity?
Oh yeah, we had the Cabbage Patch with my daughter. We had the Legos with my son. Everything Batman, everything Ninja, everything, who's
Teenage
a,
Mutant?
Teenage
Ninja?
Mutant,
yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that whole thing with the boys, they had all those.
All that stuff.
But Legos was the big thing.
Legos, it's still big.
It is.
It's like, Legos are just like sort of this universal timeless toy that everybody's going
to
play with.
Yeah, and then it was a shame when later everything was video games. Every year they had to get, you know, one or two, and video games were $60 a piece.
I know.
You know, and you had to get those, and then the toys kind of went out the window.
Yeah, it's true. And now it's all like we had a caller say that he was trying to get his one-year-old to play with. He had a Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down.
Oh, yeah.
And he was trying to get his one-year-old to play with it, and the one-year-old was like, get that away from me because...
Yeah, give me your phone.
Give me your iPad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My granddaughter plays with her with a fake phone all the time, and she sits on her little chair in front of the TV, and it doesn't work.
Yeah,
but you know, she has a remote, and she just plays with her.
She plays with a fake phone.
Yeah, fake remote and a fake phone.
Just getting ready for the future.
Exactly.
She's doing some prep.
She's 19 months old.
Oh my God! All right. Well, thanks. Thanks.
Sure.
There's Mary. She's sharing some of her memories. If you guys want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. All right. Let's go to some more recent toys here. Let's start with the 2000s, because this is when we're going to start seeing like what maybe video games for sure, like every every year. All right, in 2000 it was the PlayStation 2. $299 for the PlayStation 2. While the original PlayStation positioned itself as leader of the new gaming guard in the mid 90s. It was the PlayStation 2 that cemented Sony's status as the veritable king of home entertainment. The console took in $250 million on the first day alone, selling out quickly due to manufacturing details and then fetching extremely high numbers on the secondhand market. Gaming has never been quite the same since. Wow. PlayStation 2. Another phone call here, 312-981-7200. This is Julie on WGN. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Nick.
Hi.
Hey, Mary was just talking about Madame Alexander dolls.
Yes.
And I had one, too. Her name was Kathy, and I still have her today.
You still have her?
I still have her, yep. I have clothes for her and that.
They do look realistic.
George. I don't know why. I was a tomboy, but it was never Kathy. It was always George.
You changed the name to George.
I did.
Yeah, and you still have it.
I did. And I still have her, and Patty Playfell, too. Uh-huh. And my mom made clothes that matched her and I both, so, yeah.
That's amazing.
Still have both of them.
All right. Okay, so, Julie, thanks.
Okay, take care.
Yeah, Madame Alexander dolls. Very popular stuff. 312-981-7200 is the phone number here. 2001, a little closer here, 2001 Bratz dolls. Estimated retail price $9.99 to $22.99. scantily dressed and brimming with sass. The appropriately named Bratz dolls were marketed as anti-Barbies for a modern audience. The initial 2001 rollout included just four dolls, but that number rapidly grew as profits soared. A slew of movies, CDs, shows, and video games naturally followed. 2002, Beyblades. Retail price $10 and up, with roots in Japanese manga series. Beyblades are spinning tops that do battle against one another inside a toy stadium. Their explosive success resulted in nationwide tournaments, while the manga books were developed into an anime TV series that ran for three seasons.
Are you curious? Really? I didn't remember that.
The Beyblades.
Can I still get spinning tops?
I think you can.
I need to get spinning tops.
Oh, now she's obsessed. That's it. She's obsessed now.
I remember them so well. Yeah. I loved them.
So these were some of the other ones that I remember the Bratz dolls. That was a big deal when the Bratz dolls were out. People were protesting them and stuff.
Yeah, they were. Some of them looked a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, much. And my daughter was not into them at all.
No, not at all.
No.
They did make a movie out of it, I remember. And, you know, they did do a TV series and all that stuff. But, yeah. All right. What about this? Robo Sapien. This was the big toy in 2004. Designed by Mark Tilden and manufactured by Wowie Toys, Robo Sapien was a remote-controlled robot capable of vocals and 67 pre-programmed moves. In an extra clever touch of ingenuity, Robo Sapien would imitate the iconic Rosebud scene from Citizen Kane every time you turned it off using the remote. What? What? So did they assume kids know what the Rosebud thing from Citizen Kane is, or is it just some sort of joke that the programmers did? I've never heard. Have you ever heard of Robo Sapien?
I had seen it, but I had not. I didn't know all the whole backstory.
Wow, $99, and it was popular in 2004. Jeez. All right, we got a break here, and then we'll wrap up the talk about toys for Christmas. After we take a break here for the weather, and my dad's going to tell a joke, too, on this Monday jokey morning.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go!
Yes, that's right. And it is Monday morning. That means my dad tells a joke, and he's been doing it for many, many years with us now. He calls in every Monday morning, and we hear a joke. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, and we are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here till 5 o'clock. Coming up, Steve Grzanich with the opening bell, and coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. All right, let's bring my dad in. Morning, Dad.
Morning.
How you doing?
How you doing, Nick?
I'm all right. How are you?
Doing good.
How's Ma?
Mom's good.
Good. All right. Got a joke?
Got a joke. A child comes home from her first day of school. Her father asks, "What did you learn?" The daughter replied, "Not enough. They want me to come back tomorrow."
All right. That's a good one, Dad.
All right.
All right, buddy. Talk to you soon.
All right.
See
bye.
You later. There you go. There's my dad. They want me to come back tomorrow. See?
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
That's right. He'll do it again next Monday as well. So, let's see. More popular toys from more recent years. 2005, Xbox 360. 2006, the Nintendo Wii. 2007, Guitar Hero. Boy, they're all. You see where this all went. By the way, the Nintendo Wii. My friend had the Nintendo Wii, and you know how you ever played the Nintendo Wii?
I have, yes.
Where you can like make an avatar of yourself. That was the best. That was my favorite part, was just making an avatar of me. And again, it looked like me too. Like you could pick the color and all that other stuff. You can really. And I like that. My favorite part of it was that you would create all these like sort of avatars and characters, and they would just kind of wander around in a room. That was just watching them walk around in a room and bump into each other. And that's my favorite. That was more fun than actually playing the game, was to watch the avatars just kind of roam around like a whole, but me and a bunch of my friends just kind of walking around like animated versions of ourselves, just kind of wandering around in some big room, bumping into each other. 2008. Oh, I like this. WALL-E toys. Really? That was the biggest? Original estimated retail price, $7 and up. Renowned for its sophisticated themes and stunning visuals, Disney Pixar's 2008 film WALL-E played to all ages and enraptured an audience of millions. In spite of the film's wasteland vibes, Disney quickly released tons of subsequent WALL-E merchandise that sold in large enough quantities to help actualize the film's own dire predictions. I don't know why I'm surprised by that. I remember the movie being big. I just don't remember people going nuts and buying the toys. So that's still my favorite Pixar movie. Still my favorite. Let's see. 2009, Angry Birds. 2010, the iPad. Let's see. We got a bunch of texts coming in. Susie, what about 1960? She asks. That would be the Etch-a-Sketch. Yeah. Originally known as L'Ecran Magique, which translates to magic screen, Etch-a-Sketch was the brainchild of French electrical technician André Cassenègue. He shopped his product for a year without having much luck until the Ohio Art Company decided to spend $25,000 on the licensing rights. The toy was renamed in the process. After some choice television spots, the Etch-a-Sketch shot to the top of Santa's wish lists all around the country in 1960. What was the big toy year? Let's see. Now, 2018 would be Don't Step in It this year. Only January 2019 will tell what 2018 top toy will be. But at the rate the Amazon exclusive unicorn edition of Hasbro's Don't Step in It game is selling out, America may have a clue. Players mold rainbow colored clay into piles of unicorn poop, place them on a floor mat, and take a number of blindfolded steps determined by a spinner across the mat while trying to avoid stepping in piles. What? What? Is that real? It's unicorn poop is what you're not supposed to step. That's don't step in it. The Toy Insider's Jackie Breyer says gross out toys in general are always a hot topic. How about Canadian Bill says tabletop hockey was popular in the 70s as kids got fed up with the Leaves playing the Canadians. 219 area code says the You Fly It airplane toy, where the little airplane shot out of the string to the top of a door and then turned around on its own and flew back on the string. You had it land on a runway, which was included in the toy. 847 area code. What about Ginnip Ganop, which was ping pong spelled backwards? The hell was that?
That was me.
Oh, it was so loud, they said, of the toy. 708 area code said, I loved my Mighty Men and Monster Maker. Okay, 1955, somebody wanted to know. Silly Putty. The original retail price, $1. No one's sure who invented Silly Putty, but nearly all agree that the strange material was invented by accident. The story goes that during World War II, the U.S. government commissioned some chemists to create a synthetic rubber substitute that resulted in a strange material that was prone to melting and couldn't hold a solid shape, and therefore had no discernible use. The government's loss was the toys industry's gain, though. However, by 1955, the small plastic eggs filled with Silly Putty were aimed squarely at the youth market with wildly successful results. And while the whole dollar might seem high for Silly Putty circa 1955, what's even more astounding is that the price has never really changed over the course of 60 years. And then someone wanted to know 1966 Twister. Original retail price not available. Board manufacturer Milton Bradley was initially nervous about marketing Twister, worried the game's frisky undertones might blemish the company's upright reputation. In spite of these reservations, the company put Twister on the shelves in 1965 to little fanfare. It wasn't until Johnny Carson played the game on TV with voluptuous Ava Gabor that teens saw the potential, and Twister has been the cornerstone of youth culture ever since. So we can thank Johnny Carson and Ava Gabor for the success of Twister. All right. All right. We'll take a break. The news is coming up right after this.